Are you searching for the best in online black radio? Then go to blacktalkradionetwork.com, helping you filter through the noise. Real talk, black talk.
The internet is full of half-truths and all-out lies. We've all seen them, and many people on social media complaining about it. Here's your chance to show and prove. WorldAfropedia.com is a black-owned and operated encyclopedia. There are several thousand articles, but we need help. We can't uncover all the truth ourselves. So please, join us and become a writer, editor, or blogger for WorldAfropedia.com today. Every little bit counts. We owe it to the future generations to put the truth out there. Visit WorldAfropedia.com, the African-centered encyclopedia, a global database of African knowledge for the purpose of bringing about global African wisdom and understanding. WorldAfropedia.com.
All I wanted was to see a movie. One down, please.
I can't sell downstairs tickets to you people.
How dare they?
How dare they? Exactly what she would say.
I run my own business.
Her sister's story in a Heritage Minute. Many call Viola Desmond a quiet revolutionary. But to Wanda Robson, the youngest in a family of 11, Vi will always be big sis.
Viola looked out for me and my brother Jackie. We lived on the corner of Gosserton and Gary Street. Two flats. So we moved up. The family had dwindled down to just I and my brother by that time. Viola and her, she was married. They took the first flat, and they had no living room. That was the beauty parlor and the kitchen, and that's how she started. The people were coming. You could hear them coming and going all the time.
Owning her beauty salon did not come easily. Viola was denied formal training in Halifax because of the color of her skin. So she trained in Montreal, New York, even Atlantic City, and learned from the likes of Madame C.J. Walker, the first black female millionaire. Back in Canada, Viola opened up her salon, set up a school to develop other black beauticians, and created her own beauty products. She spent hours, sometimes days, traveling across the Maritimes, delivering them to clients. Viola was on one of her product runs November 8, 1946, when her car broke down in New Glasgow. She decided to see a movie, and that changed the course of history.
I could afford to buy the more expensive ticket. I run my own business.
The usher came up and said, "Miss, you're sitting in the wrong seat. You can't sit there." She said, "That's the seat. It's more expensive. Viola said, "Well, I'll go and I'll pay the difference."
But they refused to take my money.
She said, "I always sit down when I'm in Halifax." She went down and sat down. When the usher came again and said, "I'll have to get the manager," Viola said, "Get the manager. I'm not doing anything wrong." The manager took one arm and took the other, dragging her up, and she lost a shoe and a purse, and somebody picked and retrieved them. The policeman called a taxi. The manager went to the courts to get an order for her arrest. Now, arrest for what? She goes to prison. And one thing I say, she was a jailer. I take her to jail. I say, "Viola, you know, jail. I mean, what did you do?"
They said I didn't pay the theater tax. But it was really about color.
She made this, I think, was a conscious response of rebellion. "I'm not doing this."
And I think the impact for me was to show how a small act can become something even bigger.
Former Lieutenant Governor Mayanne Francis was a part of that bigger moment decades later, issuing a pardon to Viola Desmond in April 2010, a request initiated in writing by Viola's younger sister.
She knew an injustice was done to her sister, and she fought to make sure that it was undone in her lifetime. So it was a very moving experience for me knowing that I was the one, a black woman, was going to be given Viola Desmond, something that she should have had a long time ago, her freedom. I remember my heart was just beating away, and it was so many people, so many cameras, and I kept thinking, this is for you, Viola. And there she is.
As fate would have it, Mayan Francis lives next to the Camp Hill Cemetery in Halifax, where Viola was buried in 1965.
Viola I. Davis Desmond, 1914-1965.
She made it her mission to have Viola's gravesite officially marked with signs. She's also responsible for this. A portrait of Viola hanging on the Government House walls. And this was Wanda Robson's response, seeing it for the first time.
Wanda looks at it and she goes up closer and she says, "Hi, Vi." You know, yeah, she put her hand up and she said, "Hi, Vi." It was really
the pardon, the portrait, the graveside markers, it all leads back to Wanda and her quest for justice.
My family had a front row, and this is what we got.
A framed copy of the pardon hangs at the front of Wanda's home, keeping her sister's memory, her place in history nearby. And if Viola was alive to see it today,
she'd read it. And she'd say, Wani, did you do that? I'd say with a lot of help. I'm so proud of you. I'm so proud of you. And I love you very much. That's what she'd say. She's something else. I loved her.
Asha Tomlinson, CBC News, Sydney, Nova Scotia.
Context of white supremacy. Gusty Renegade in for another broadcast, hopefully to share constructive information on the system of white supremacy. Today's date, Wednesday, June 29th, 2016. So I have been told. Our timing got thrown off just a tad. If things had worked out according to our original schedule, we would have had on Monday, we would have had Afua Cooper on the program, and we were going to be discussing her book, The Hanging of Angelique, The Untold Story of Canadian Slavery and the Burning of Old Montreal. But the U.S. Postal Service failed us. I blame Obama for that, too. The book did not arrive. I've been waiting and waiting and waiting, like weeks, for the book to arrive, and it just never got here. It finally arrived Monday afternoon. I got it. We were supposed to do the program on Monday, so obviously I could not read it in a matter of minutes. So we are attempting to reschedule with Ms. Cooper for some time either next week or the following week in July to discuss that. But it would have been so cool because these what we're going to talk about today merges right together, and we would have really got to flex our international might in terms of discussing, dissecting the global system of racism, white supremacy, because our Sunday program, we had a guest from South Africa. Monday, we would have had a guest from Canada, and then today, a guest from Canada. Global problem of racism, white supremacy, but we will make do. One of our listeners in Canada recommended that we get some of the folks on north of the border to get more of their history, understanding of racism, white supremacy. Viola Desmond, you heard in the introductory clip, black female, 1946, was not allowed to sit in the white section of a movie theater, was snatched, removed from the theater. I think, folks, anyone who has studied U.S. history, many examples of that sort of thing happening to black people, theaters, buses, trains, even reminded me of Ida B. Wells, Ida B. Wells Barnett, infamous black journalist, famous black journalist, counter-racist, who had the same problem and was snatched off of a train. But long-running problem and worldwide in the system of racism, white supremacy. Our guest for today's program, he wrote about not only what happened to Viola Desmond, but also the history of white supremacy in Canada and some of the parallels with things that were happening in the U.S. and how that relates to what Canada looks like today, and the way that people think about Canada as kind of being the promised land where there is no racism. This is a great spot where black people have run from nasty white supremacy in the U.S., slavery and what have you, where they have come here to find some sort of sanctuary. I think his book works to kind of puncture that mythology and show how you have a lot of parallels in Canada as well as the U.S., I would submit, worldwide. Our guest for today's broadcast, see if I can get the full official title for his position. He is the Viola Desmond Chair in Social Justice at Cape Breton University. He's a professor emeritus, a historian, and an author. The book that we're going to talk about today just published 2016, hot off the presses. The full title, Viola Desmond's Canada, A History of Blacks and Racial Segregation in the Promised Land. Be a grand, will be a hoot to have him on the program, get information, and we encourage our listeners who are in Canada to dial in if you all have questions that you would like to ask. Joining us live, our guest, Mr. Graham Reynolds. Mr. Reynolds, you're with us, sir?
Yes, I am. Good to be here.
Outstanding. Thank you for sharing a bit of your time and energy with us this Wednesday afternoon, I guess for you this Wednesday evening. For our listening audience, I'm sure this is their first time hearing from you. Anything that you think would be constructive for them to know about who you are and the work that you do?
I am a professor of history at Cape Breton University, and I've been teaching in the area of the history of race relations for probably 30 years. So I've been following the history of race relations in Canada and in the United States, and teaching generations of students in this part of the country. In any event, and I'm very pleased to be with you tonight and or this afternoon, I guess it is in the Pacific area. And I think that the book really speaks for itself in terms of giving an outline of the history of race relations in Canada, which is really quite different than what most Canadians think it has been, in that we are very much more like the United States than we like to admit. And I think that if we could start, you know, with slavery and take it right up to contemporary times, and we'd see parallels all the way through from this 16th century, 17th century, right up through to 2016.
We will attempt to do that. We'll see how much material we can cover, try to get as much in the time that we have you today, and coming right on up to Black Lives Matter Toronto, which we've talked about on this program as well. For folks who have not seen you, you are a white man. Is that correct?
I am a white man.
Right on.
Yes, I am.
This program, I use the term racism and the term white supremacy. I use those two terms as synonyms. I use the same definition for both terms. That definition is as follows: a global system of people who classify themselves as white and are dedicated to abusing and or subjugating everyone in the known universe whom they classify as not white. Do you think such a system exists? Do you think that definition is accurate?
I think that if you look at the course of history, certainly for the last, since the beginnings of the transatlantic slave trade, and even before, the factor of race has gotten stronger and stronger as a defining element in terms of human relationships. And I think it began to really take off in terms of a principle and a doctrine in the 19th century. Certainly, evidence of that much before, as I said. But I think the 19th century is the birth of the racial topology that is very much still the prevailing mindset in the 21st century. So I would agree with it from a historical perspective, and say, as much as we all would like to live in a different age where there is no racial division and white racism, it's almost impossible to avoid it. It's there in so many different ways, and even in countries, as I said, like Canada, where We have the sort of the semblance of tolerance and racial equality, but very much under the surface, and it doesn't take much to stir it up. So I think I would agree with that in the largest sense of a historical doctrine that definitely has a grip on the human condition in the 21st century.
Okay. I have been asking white guests who have come to the program over the years. There's a quote. It's been about a year and a half now, written by a non-white author. He was talking about racism. In the quote, he says, "White people are often sincerely and greatly pained by racism, but rarely are they pained enough." And I've really just been focusing on the first part of the question. We strive for accuracy, people being truthful about things on this here program. You as a white person and as a historian, just your experience, your studies, I'm sure you have white family members, white people that you know, your time on this here planet, do you think the first portion of that sentence is true, that white people are often sincerely and greatly pained by racism? And I mean like a sizable portion of white people, do you think are sincerely, truthfully, greatly pained by racism?
I think so. I think that, we have to be, I think, generous to people who are aware of the facts and try to pursue social justice and truth. And I think that the more one begins to ask the right kind of questions and examines the facts, I think the more one is drawn to the recognition that prejudice is a part of the human condition, and racism is the modern expression of that, and the race that's divided by color in North America, especially the division of white and black is still the defining element in terms of human relationships. You know, I think to be honest, I think that we overlook the power and influence of the institution of racial slavery, which I think has defined North American politics. Certainly, we know that the United States is very much defined by the conditions of slavery and the forced importation of over 10 million Africans who were forced into the transatlantic slave trade, and the consequences of that over hundreds of years has left its mark. And I try to do in my book is to try to raise that question in terms of what the Canadian experience has been. And
Reynolds, I just wanted to hop in there. And one of the things, if I can make a request, if you can make an effort to accurately answer the question, because it's been my experience that frequently, particularly when I'm talking to white people, they will stray from the question that's being asked. In fact, sometimes I think that's one of the ways that white people deliberately practice racism, by not answering questions or deviating or just being vague in their responses. The question that I asked was about white people are often sincerely and greatly pained by racism. And I believe at the beginning you said, yes, you think that that's true.
Yes.
Okay. If you think that's true, how do, and I mean like a sizable number of white people, how do they demonstrate that they are sincerely, often sincerely and greatly pained by racism? How is that demonstrated?
Well, I think that, again, I have to speak as a historian. I think that we have made some advances that have been the collective efforts, the result of collective efforts of well-informed whites and blacks working together to change the course of history. And I don't want to make too much of this. I don't want to say, that we've made a post-racial society. We haven't come even close. But I do think that there has been some progress. I don't want to go stray beyond my area, but I do think in terms of world awareness that race is a factor, and I think that whites and the more they become again aware of the facts, the more they are able to deal with those facts, and the more they try to move toward a better society. At least I hope that's true. I wouldn't, if it's not, then we don't have any hope. I think that we do have some evidence of progress, and I think that the last 50 years, the last 60 years in the United States has evidenced some degree of progress. Again, I can't overstate it, but I think that's my evidence that whites have definitely done something to change the brutal reality of racism.
Okay. And see, that's the type of thing that I mean in the response that you gave. You're still not really answering the question. The question was, how do whites demonstrate? What is the evidence that they are sincerely and greatly pained by racism? And just saying that there's been progress, quote unquote, and you hope that things are better, that's not really answering the question.
Well, I think that again, over the, I'm just speaking as a historian, whites have contributed to by demonstrating and taking up the cause and becoming involved in civil rights and addressing issues of injustice.
Okay. I want to just hang on right there because okay. This is the type of thing I encourage our listeners to evaluate, particularly when you're talking to a white person. And even before I give my response, do you think it's logical, it's reasonable for any non-white person in the world to be suspicious of any white person, that white person could be racist? Do you think that's logical?
Yes.
Okay. So just evaluating what you just said in response to my question, saying that there have been white people who have contributed to civil rights and worked against racism. Now, if I'm looking at that, what you just said, in comparison to the vast numbers of white people who have done absolutely nothing with regards to racism in any era, whether it's slavery, Jim Crow, the Klan, segregation, Black Lives Matter, whatever, any of the whites who have done nothing and or the whites who have labored and given it their all to support white supremacy, what am I to think of a white person who says the white people who have worked and contributed to quote unquote civil rights and or racism? I mean, that number seems really, really paltry. I would almost say insignificant in comparison to the whites who have done nothing or given it their all in support of white supremacy, many of whom you document in your book.
Yeah, I agree. I think that there can be and should be a lot more involvement and a lot more awareness. That's why I wrote the book. I'm trying to shake up a country to be aware of the fact that we have a history, a shared history with the United States, and that we have, the skeletons in our closet that haven't been addressed, and we haven't engaged in a meaningful dialogue about our history. And I think it's time that we do this. Or we simply repeat the same mistakes over and over again. It took 64 years for Viola Desmond to receive any degree of justice that she so deserved, for the government of Nova Scotia to issue a mercy-free pardon. And that's too long to wait. That's too long to be aware of the deep-rooted racism that's part of our white society in Canada. So I wrote the book to try to address this issue and to engage in what we're doing right here, which is try to start a dialogue that raises awareness and hopefully makes changes. If you don't become aware of the problem, you can't effectively change it.
Hmm. Fascinating. Just from your response right there, to me, it strongly suggests that, I mean, just even with Viola Desmond's incidents alone, that it took 64 years to pardon and acknowledge that we mistreated Miss Desmond. We practiced racism against her. This was an injustice. This was wrong. That, to me, suggests strongly that whites, that a sizable number of whites are not sincerely and greatly pained by racism. But folks can.
No, I would agree with that. I think that there's been, as I said in the book, a collective amnesia about race, certainly in Canada. I can't speak for the United States, but certainly for Canada, there's been a lack of awareness and lack of recognition of the narrative of race in the Canadian context. And I think it's so long overdue that we engage in this kind of discussion and reach out and try to get people to become aware of the past and make a difference for the future.
Okay. I want to point out for our listeners just your responses, because I mean, it took a long time when you finally saying that you would agree in terms of me saying that there's no evidence that white people are sincerely and greatly pained by racism with Ms. Desmond's case or others. I suspect that you could be deliberately practicing racism and not being honest in some of your responses. I hope that, you know, we can be as honest as possible. If that's your goal with the book and, you know, having these sort of discussions. And again, this is a pattern I've seen when white people talk about racism, white supremacy. see them not being honest. And even the point that you made about this collective amnesia, I know that's something that you raise in your book, and that's widespread where many, many white people and even a large number of non-white people say that white people have an amnesia or they're not aware or they're confused about racism. And I've stated emphatically, nothing could be further from the truth. That is one of the greatest just out and out lies, in my opinion, that the problem is not that white people have amnesia, that they've forgotten or that they're not informed. The problem is that white people are dedicated to racism, white supremacy. The problem is not a lack of information, but we'll get to that as we go through your book. Just one other question I want to ask before we get to some of the details of your book, Viola Desmond's Canada. Mr. Reynolds, have you ever had a problem currently talking to Gus here today or any other time? Have you had a problem being honest when communicating with other non-white people about racism? And when I say being honest, that is either withholding any aspect of pertinent information related to what's being discussed and or not being completely accurate with the way that you articulate, converse about the topic being discussed. Has that ever been a problem for you, being honest when talking to other non-white people about racism?
Gus, I can only say that I do my very best to try to be honest with what I'm saying and with what I believe is the truth. But I got to tell you that we live in a cultural environment in which everyone is affected by the history and the culture we live in. So I cannot say that I am free of prejudice or I am free of the influence of a culture which is deeply ingrained with racism. So to be honest with you, I think everyone to some degree is a racist, in that they are a product of the culture in which they are born into. And it is the struggle to be aware of that and to overcome that is certainly been my quest. So I'm agreeing with you, or I'm saying that, no, I haven't been honest in all respects in every single way, because I'm struggling with the influence that I have had or what society has done for me. So we live in we are a product of the culture that we live in. So if we're living in a racist society, guess what? We're racists to some degree, and it's the struggle to overcome that I think is very important. And that's been my intellectual and emotional quest as far as an academic for the last 30 years, is to try to be honest in confronting these issues and trying to raise awareness with my students. I am not trying to escape the question. I'm admitting, like everyone else, that we are living in a racist society, and to some degree that rubs off on us.
And this is one of those where, I mean, you know, being as accurate as possible when talking about these issues. If you're saying that everyone is racist, in my view, we certainly could not be saying that Viola Desmond is racist. We certainly could not be saying that Andrew Locu is racist. So if we're going to be totally honest, we would have to be saying that white people are racist. The non-white people would have to be the victims of racism, that if we are in a society dominated by white supremacy racism, then if you are white, that would mean you are racist. Would that be most accurate?
I think that's certainly the weight of the truth is on that, for sure. I think that whites are the source of racism, and certainly in history that's been the case.
Okay. Would it be accurate to say that you, since you said you're still working through it, you're a white man, we're in a system of white supremacy, would it be accurate to say that you, Mr. Graham Reynolds, are a racist?
I would admit that I'm the product of the culture I've been born into, and I'm wrestling with that. So sure, I mean, if that's a statement if I fit the mold, then obviously that's the truth.
Okay. Context of white supremacy, much honesty as we can bear. I'm going to try and cover as much as I, because you do cover a pretty wide swath of history in the book. So I'm going to try to cover as much as we can and go through some of these issues that come up as we discuss what you've written on the text of Viola Desmond's Canada, and then we'll get to some of the callers as well. You already kind of shared some of your reasoning, motivation for why you wrote this book, to get some of this information out. To address what you labeled it as amnesia, or just people not knowing about stories in terms of what happened to Viola Desmond, there being kind of an underrepresentation, people not knowing about the significant number of black people who have been in Canada for centuries, people not knowing about the influence of Marcus Garvey and others. We'll kind of touch on some of these incidents as we roll through the book. One of the first things that stood out This is on page, I have the e-copy of the book, so I guess this is an introduction. If people have the actual physical copy, page numbers might not match up. You know, you can figure it out, though. So in the introductory, you write that we, talking about Canadians, we do not understand that the surveillance and pursuit of escaping ex-slaves by professional slave hunters called patrollers in the mid-19th century led to the rise of the bounty hunter, including TV's Dog the Bounty Hunter and Like Bloodhounds. I thought that was really important because you do talk about how this was kind of a tension in terms of enslaved black people trying to escape and going into Canada, and then white racist enslavers pursuing their property and saying, hey, you all in Canada have a duty to return our niggers, give us our property back. And there being some tension around that. Can you speak to that for our listeners?
Yes, I think that that certainly was the case in the history. And that quote, by the way, is George Eliot Clark, who wrote the foreword to the book. And George Eliot Clark was generous enough to take the task on, and I think he did a nice job in terms of casting and providing a context for the book. But the arm of American slaveholders extended certainly into Canada, and although the law said, in terms of the Canadian British law during the 19th century, that it was not legal for American patrollers to come across and nab slaves to take them back, take blacks back into the confines of slavery in the United States, they nevertheless did it. And there are some remarkable examples of that in the course of history. And it's not something which, Canadians are fully aware of.
For sure. And that's one of the things I would hope people kind of keep that aware of, the terminology bounty hunters. I don't know if people frequently connect that to the institution of black enslavement in this area of the world, just showing how entrenched white supremacy is in all aspects in terms of how we think, and even we're not aware of it a lot of times. And I'm talking about non-white people not being aware. You also, one of the things that I thought was important, even with this, talking about how there was slavery in Canada, it certainly was not as widespread as it was in the U.S. and other parts of the Americas, but it was there. And this is also from the introduction, as you said, Dr. George Eliot Clark, where he says it's eye-opening. For instance, it is eye-opening to read, for instance, of the advertised sale of a Negro wench, Creole-born, who can cook and clean and do every other thing that can be expected from such a slave. Canadians have long understood that African heritage female slaves could be fondled, raped, even impregnated by masters and overseers down south or on Caribbean Isles of Sugar and Sun, but the cited advertisement is from a 1752 vintage Halifax, Nova Scotia newspaper. And I think that's really important just because for me, it just further reinforces, when we talk about the global aspects of white supremacy, this rape of black people, males, females, children, is integral, seems to be one of the central aspects of white supremacy culture. And this seemed to be operating north of the border as well. And you even talk about that later on in the book about these the special value to these Creole enslaved black people because they're lighter complexion. They have a higher value to be sexually exploited. Can you speak to that, Mr. Reynolds?
Well, I think that wherever you have slavery, you have the existence of sexual exploitation. I mean, slavery is a power system, and it has in its history always brought to the surface sexual exploitation. And certainly in the institution of slavery in Canada, we have in every case with the French and with the English as well, the fact that slaves were property meant that they were at the discretion of their master, of the owners that exploited slaves, even in rather benign, and I use that word cautiously, situations where you have for example with a woman that I spend some time talking about, Marie Margaret Rose, who's history really needs to be taught much more in our schools. The recognition of this incredible, extraordinary woman who lived as a slave in the fortress of Lewisburg for over 20 years. She was enslaved in Africa, brought to the French West Indies, and then sold into slavery, brought to the fortress of Lewisburg in Ile Royale, which is now, of course, Cape Breton Island. And she served as a domestic servant for some 20 years, but was sexually exploited by the owner, this Lieutenant Lippincott, who, as a result of that exploitation, she had a child that died later as a young teenager. And then she was finally given her freedom at the old age of 38. She lived well beyond the average age of a slave during this period. And she married a Mi'kmaq and took up ownership of a tavern in Lewisburg and showed incredible talents of business. And even though she was illiterate, she was able to engage in very sophisticated exchanges of business with the merchants in Lewisburg had a very successful business for a short period of time. And then she died quite suddenly of natural causes when she was the age of 40. But Lewisburg is a good example where there were a large number of slaves, 260 some slaves, and about a third of those slaves were exploited sexually in terms of having giving birth to children out of marriage that were the result of the masters and the whites that were party to the sexual exploitation. And certainly with the English, that practice continued. And that advertisement, by the way, was a particular merchant that was advertising the sale of a handful of slaves that he brought to Halifax in 1752. And he frequently brought numbers of slaves for sale during that period. Hmm. So I think that's the condition of slavery is sexual exploitation. So it's almost synonymous with the condition of being considered to be property.
Hmm. You also include in the book how black people, black females, I make sure to include black females, black males, black children, that whether you were enslaved or even if you were a free black person, that you still could be subjected to this sexual exploitation, rape, in a system of racism, white supremacy. Would it be accurate? I've been trying to ask many of our guests, particularly those who've written about slavery. Would it be accurate and assist? Do you think one of the central aspects of white culture, white supremacy culture, is the rape of black people?
I think yes. In terms of the any exploitation is again when you consider the nature of slavery itself, it's a form of rape. Sure, certainly, when you treat a human being as property and exploit that person for sexual desire or for any other purpose, so it's just part of the whole dynamic of power that slavery exercises over a human being and removes the humanity and treats an individual as mere property. So it is rape in every possible sense of the term.
I just want to make sure we're clear for our listeners, because I have concluded that white supremacy, even 2016 global white supremacy, is slavery. But just to make sure we're clear for our listeners, because the question I asked, I was not just talking about the formal plantation era slavery. Yeah. Any aspect of white supremacy, any aspect of what is happening, whether we're talking about things that were happening in the 17th century or right now, that a fundamental aspect, a central defining aspect of white supremacy culture, white culture, is the rape of black people. Is that an accurate statement?
I can say that I think that's in the largest sense of the term. Yeah, I don't use those terms when I teach, and I don't.
Which terms?
I don't talk to my students in terms of the race relations as a continuing example of exploitation and rape in the 21st century. But I have to respect your perspective on this, and from your perspective,
but is that true? I mean, not my perspective. I mean, just the evidence, the logic. Is that true? is what we're talking about ongoing?
Gus, if we're talking about systemic racism, I think that it is ingrained into the system. So that I think in that sense, yes. But individuals aren't engaged in rape in because they are part of the dominant white society. So I mean, I think that you have to put it into the context of the institution and the ideology that is expressive of this white supremacy that is found obviously in the history and in the culture of white society. So yes, from a systemic perspective, but not. I don't think every white individual is engaged in the practice of raping of people of color. It's not my belief anyway.
Well, I'm not talking about belief. I'm just talking about the evidence, looking at the record, and even making sure that we keep in mind that many times when people are raped and sexually violated, it does not get reported. But certainly the record speaks for itself in terms of the formal plantation era of white supremacy, slavery. Even moving forward from there, there is pretty extensive documentation. I know Rosa Parks, I'm certainly going to get to her later on, documents this, Fannie Lou Hamer, many other black people worldwide, sure. Even the case of Daniel Holtzclaw here in the States, have documented Dominic Strauss-Kahn with the IMF and the case that happened in New York not that long ago, that this seems to be an ongoing pattern of white people raping, sexually violating black people, males, females, children. The case in Idaho where they had the white terrorist teenagers who gang raped a young disabled black teenager in Idaho. This was at 2015 where this just took place. Even the white people that are not directly engaged to this, there certainly seems to be a lot of enabling, aiding, and abetting where they know that this is going on. Same thing I said at the beginning, where either they're not doing anything or they are condoning this, and or when it does come out, they don't believe the black person and they participate in covering up and allowing for this to continue. I would submit not my perspective, not my view, just the record looking at the evidence.
Yes.
There seems to be overwhelming evidence and worldwide that this is a pretty central aspect of how white people function in relation to black people, that this is one of the main ways we practice white supremacy racism. And either it's true or it's not. I would even point this out for listeners that we're talking to a professor here. I suspect that you know a lot of this. This could just be another example of you not being honest, maybe even deliberately practicing racism in your response. But
well, I think that's an unfair comment, Gus. I don't look. I think that what you say is true. In individual cases, there are many, many examples, more than we would like to admit, more than we know that exists where whites have raped and have engaged in unacceptable, terrible practices in terms of racism against blacks, certainly in the United States, and I suspect to some degree even in Canada. But to go from that statement to say that all whites are culpable is, to me, is a break in logic. I can't agree with you that we condemn the entire group of white people, including myself, as being participants in the act of rape. I think that degrees of culpability, those that are clearly racist, engaged in the practice of rape or other practices of dehumanizing conduct, is certainly the case. And there are others, enablers that are certainly there. People that are not looking, just like in Nazi Germany. In the Holocaust, many were directly involved. Others were aware, but I don't think it's fair to condemn all whites and all white society as being the same degree of again culpability in the act of violence.
Okay, I will point out for listeners, just being correct about terms, what I said was a fundamental aspect of white culture. I didn't say all white people rape black people. What I said specifically was the rape of black people. This is a fundamental, central aspect of white culture. And I'm just reminding you so I can move back to the text. Okay. You did say that it's logical, yeah, it's reasonable to be suspicious, yeah, of any white person, even you.
Absolutely.
That they, okay, right on.
Absolutely.
Moving forward in the book, you're talking about some of the stereotypes that I guess we would generally associate with the United States, that a lot of these were heavily present in Canada as well, talking about some of the Sambo stereotypes that black people are lazy, childlike, ignorant. I'm just reading from the text here. I think this is on page 18. Again, I have the e-copy. This image of blacks became so widespread in North America, Canada included, that nearly a century later, it influenced aspects of the character Tom in New England abolitionist Harriet Beecher Stowe's popular Uncle Tom's Cabin. Tom was inspired by the real-life figure Josiah Henson, a fugitive slave who figured prominently in the development of the Underground Railroad and the establishment of an independent and self-reliant black community in Ontario during the 19th century. Stowe reflected the racial views of her generation, and in her novel, the majority of the fugitive slaves who sought exile in Canada were of mixed blood. She believed that it was the seed of freedom contained in the white blood that flowed through the veins of mixed-race fugitives that led them to seek the promised land. Just for our listeners who might not be informed, the significance of Josiah Henson, figure that was based, this real-life black person who was came to represent Harriet Beecher Stowe's Uncle Tom?
Yeah, Josiah Henson was a significant player in the Underground Railroad, and one could say he was one of several significant individuals that really gave impetus to the creation of a chain of relationships that brought fugitive slaves to Canada and the so-called Underground Railroad. So he was really an important figure historically. Made his way from Kentucky to eventually Ontario, and established through the help of others that were involved in the Underground Railroad. He established an independent black community that was self-reliant and very forward-looking in terms of its emphasis upon education and the value of community service, that those that were educated in the community turn their service back into their debt back into society, and it prospered for a period of time. And was really one of seven independent black communities that were established in the 19th century in Ontario. So he's a really important figure in the history of the Underground Railroad and the establishment of an independent black settlement in Canada. And today, in fact, there is the Uncle Tom's Cabin Museum, which is near Dresden, which is a community which really, it's curious, it has the legacy of being the part of the terminus of the Underground Railroad, so it has the positive aspect of being the place where fugitive slaves ended up and then established themselves. But on the other side of that, the downside is Dresden became the Mississippi of Canada during the 20th century, up and through the 1940s, and was the, I guess, the worst example of blatant, overt racial segregation.
Wow. Even before we get to 20th century and how all this was manifested, you write a little bit before there. This is on page 19 going over into 20, where you write that white loyalists, these are whites who were loyal to Britain at the time, white loyalists were also frustrated by the inaction of the colonial administration in fulfilling the promise of providing land to all those who supported the British in the American Revolutionary War. On July 26, 1784, violence erupted when a mob of disbanded soldiers attacked free blacks and destroyed approximately 20 of their newly constructed homes. Marston witnessed the event and wrote in his diary that the race riot was an attempt by the unruly disbanded soldiers to drive the Negroes out of town because they labor cheaper than they will, meaning the white people will. Should sound familiar to folks. This sort of thing has happened in the States regularly. Whites feeling that Negroes represent some sort of threat to their jobs or white women or whatever the threat is perceived to be. And we've got to run them out of town. This sort of thing has happened on a regular basis. But the thing that stood out for me, and this has popped up regularly, if folks remember, we had an audio segment on the program roughly, I think, about a month ago in Tennessee with that word race riot. Where the same thing happened. Whites came in and killed a whole lot, lots of black people, and they used the term race riot. And the black people in Tennessee objected to the use of that word because they felt it was not most accurate. And I just want to point out for listeners, you do have a quote here, but race riot is not the quote. Race riot is your own writing. In my view, that's not the most accurate term. If what we're talking about here is extremely lopsided violence where whites have way more power and they're coming in and dominating, killing large numbers of black people, then we should use terms that reflect that imbalance of power. In my view, something like white terrorism or something else would be much more accurate than race riot. That kind of makes it sound like there's just a free-for-all and, you know, they had a brawl here, black people, white people engaged in some sort of, you know, equal combat between opponents, and that's just not the case.
I agree with you 100%. I think that my use of the word race riot is more in the context of what historians have used to describe events that have that took place in the late 19th century, or sorry, the early 20th century, 26 cities in the north in the period just following the First World War experienced white initiated riots. They were mobs of whites that went after blacks who had moved in the Great Migration to cities like East St. Louis and Chicago. You know the history, and that's you know, books have been written on that, and the terminology is basically derived from the historical use of the term race riot in the sense of white race riot. Whites engaged in violence against blacks, and I try to make that clear. That the example of the Shelburne riot, in which these unruly whites, the mob of terrorists, if you will, the soldiers that were on the loose, attacked blacks, and blacks didn't attack back. They were victims, and that is the model of the race riots that occurred in the early 20th century in approximately 26 cities in the northern United States. And we should include Canada as well, because there was a race riot, if I can use that term, in Glace Bay. That was a smaller scale version of that. There was one in Pictou County in which whites simply forced blacks out of the community and violently engaged in what was mob riot, basically. So that's the model. It's a white race riot.
Mm-hmm. We have had some of our guests who've been on the program. I know Cameron McWhirter. He's a journalist with the Wall Street Journal. He wrote the book Red Summer, which details 1919. Mr. Reynolds is not poorly informed about this, about a lot of these incidents that happened just in 1919, Washington, D.C., Mississippi, Chicago. You mentioned the Chicago incident in your book.
I
took up the same issue with him because he uses that term race riot, and he agreed it's not accurate. And in my view, as we move forward, we should refine and improve. In my view, this should be categorized as terrorism, because that's what it is. If this was anybody else, if this was Muslims, if this was dark people going to do this with white people, it would not be a race riot. It would be terrorism. That's what this is. And it fits the pattern, in my view, of whites not being classified as terrorists when they go out and commit massive acts of terrorism against black people.
And I think language is important. And I think I think you're right in terms of how we use the term terror and terrorism in the 21st century. I think that we can use that term in describing it in the past. But as a historian, I want to understand the historical context, and I'm not taking sort of the present view and imposing it on the past. I'm trying to kind of piece together the history. So if anything, I'm probably overly cautious in use of 21st century terminology. But I agree. I think that you're absolutely right. That in the strictest sense of the term, we're looking at terrorism. We're looking at just pure raw violence.
For sure. And I mean, even that to me, that is not enough to continue, because there is a pattern here of white people specifically, and in my view, deliberately. It's one of the main ways that they practice racism, and not using the most accurate terms to describe events that happen. And it could even just be a sentence. We put race riot in quotes because that's what it was called, but we're going to be as accurate as possible in describing things that have been historically, and again, in my view, deliberately inaccurately described or not cataloged at all. A more refined version of the exact same thing. I'm reminded of one of our other guests we had on the program, N.D.B. Connolly, his book, A World More Concrete, where he said that whites have gotten increasingly efficient at taking property from black people. And he referenced Tulsa, Oklahoma, and Rosewood, that being one form of confiscating property from black people, and saying that they have gotten better, where we don't have to come in with guns and knives and sticks and whatever else to take it from you. We can just use other methods. You talk about the area Africville. This is on page 43, The Many Faces of Jim Crow, the chapter in your book. You write, Africville was a close-knit and self-sustaining community that gradually grew from 8 original families in 1850 to over 50 families in 1964, the same year the government of Nova Scotia relocated the residents and ordered the destruction of the buildings. Historically, Africville residents had strong ties to Seaview African United Baptist Church, which was the center of the community. By the 1860s, in addition to the church, Africville had its own school, a post office, and a community store. However, as a segregated black settlement, it became increasingly marginalized as a community of outsiders. Through isolation, neglect, and prejudice, Africville underwent a process of ghettoization, and the residents were left to fend for themselves without many of the basic essentials, such as running water and police service. In periods of economic decline, the community drew a number of unemployed and dislocated people in search of cheap housing. In the white public's eye, Africville was seen as a slum community consisting of transients and squatters. In the words of one city official, it was a national blot on the city of Halifax. During the latter decades of the 19th century, the city of Halifax witnessed a process of sustained economic expansion that led to several major encroachments on Africville. Over the next century, a fertilizer plant, slaughterhouse, and a dump site with an incinerator were built very near to the community. Also, the expansion of the railroad along the Bedford Basin opened the entire area for industrial development. Eventually, a rolling mill, nail factory, coal piers, and foundries were built within short distance from Africville. The final and fatal blow to the community occurred when it was targeted for demolition in order to make way for the construction of a new bridge connecting Halifax to Dartmouth. I would just submit that this is old hat. This seems to be a standard racist procedure worldwide for how we're going to destroy black areas that are thriving and doing well. Oh, we got to put a bridge here, or a park, or a parking lot, or whatever, and you all will have to abscond, beat it, move someplace else. I think this is an extremely significant event in the history of Canada. One is, are there any markers for Africville that this happened? Yeah. And do you think it is an accurate logical comparison to say that this is on par with some of these other incidents? We don't bring guns, bombs, or whatever else in direct violence, but we just use other methods and accomplish the exact same result, moving displacement, dislocation of black people.
You've said it well. I can't disagree with that at all. That's nail on the truth as far as Africville goes. It's just terrible. A sorry chapter in Canadian history, and certainly Nova Scotia, Halifax history. There's a marker now. It's a park. There was just kind of a central park area now with a little monument plaque that acknowledges the historical importance in the existence of Africville. Certainly the residents of Africville haven't forgotten, and there's a continuous sort of reviving and commemoration of that sorry chapter in history. I think that's got to be equivalent to any of the kinds of property exploitation that's part and parcel of racism. Again, this systemic racism that's so much a part of both Canada and the United States. I have to put a footnote to this to say that in 2010, the same year that Viola Desmond was given the free pardon. The city of Halifax issued an apology, an official apology for the destruction of Africville. Not that that in any way, corrects the situation. It only acknowledges the fact that that after the fact they realized and they recognized that this was a huge, act against a community and for on racial grounds. No question about it.
Fascinating. Context of white supremacy. Again, our guest, Mr. Graham Reynolds, discussing his book, Viola Desmond's Canada. If we have, particularly our listeners in Canada, you should dial in if you have a question you would like to ask Mr. Reynolds about our discussion or what have you. Dial in. We'll get to callers in a second. Just want to pull out a few of the more important points as we roll along. You talk about, as things evolved, we get after the Civil War. You still have black people, both from America and beyond, West Indies, Caribbean, coming into Canada, United States, when I say America, coming into Canada, and just staunch effort like, whoa, we do not want the Negroes here, and coming up with a variety of creative means to see if they could stem the tide of dark people coming up north. And I just wanted to read a couple quick passages and kind of get your thoughts, because I think this shows a lot of the parallels to the United States and the thinking at the time in terms of what it means to be white, how racism, white supremacy is practiced. So one of them, this is on page 64, where, right, well, for me, it's 48, E-version, 48. So you write, the Canadian government was deeply concerned about the influx of black immigrants to Canada. Through the Immigration Acts of 1906 and 1911 and the work of the Minister of Immigration, Frank Oliver, and the Superintendent of Immigration, William D. Scott, the Laurier administration developed a multifaceted strategy to ensure that Canada would remain a nation for the white race only. The Canadian government regarded the Negro problem as an immigration issue, as it deemed blacks as undesirables on the grounds that they were physically unfit for the harsh northern climate of Canada. In addition to giving extraordinary discretionary powers, that is my word, to border officials to exclude blacks on fiscal and medical grounds, the Laurier government engaged in a campaign to dissuade blacks from immigrating to Canada. The government secretly commissioned articles published in American newspapers that described Canada's Western environment as desolate, frigid, and unsettled. I got quite a chuckle out of that passage. One of the other quick ones I'll read before we get your commentary. You write, actually, you have quite a few of the letters where different officials with the Board of Immigration and what have you, government officials are talking about this. This is kind of late 19th century, early 20th century, where they're like, oh, man, we've got a lot of these dark people that are coming in. What are we going to do? We've got to try to stop some of these folks from coming in, encourage people to hire, even though we might need laborers, particularly as we get around the era of World War II, early 20th century, World War I, excuse me, we might need laborers, and particularly black people, where we can make them work for even lower wages than whites would, that this might be desirable. But let's try to do everything we can to discourage and keep down the number of dark people that are coming to this area of the world. For me, this is on page, let's see, 130, where you have one of the letters that's republishes from April 1916, where this official, he's writing, he says, in reply, I beg to the state that after an experience of some years, both in Eastern and Western Canada, it was decided that colored immigration was no acquisition to this country, whether it be the immigration of domestics, farmers, or persons of other occupations. The movement to the West assumed considerable proportions, and it was not long after it started before we began to deport colored people. The same is true about colored domestic immigration to the East, and the particular causes for deportation have been immorality and tuberculosis. I think it is a distinct mistake to bring into Canada a class of people whose presence here constitutes a problem for all. Although just at present, it is difficult to obtain many European women. This condition is but temporary, and after the close of the war, I fancy that with the smallest amount of effort, we will be able to secure a plentiful supply of splendid women, white women, who will be an asset to Canada. I will stop there. Just can you talk about the concerted, deliberate effort to make sure we don't have too many dark folks coming into Canada?
Well, I think you've described it very well in terms of bringing the facts to bear on this. This was pretty universal in terms of government policy in the early part of the 20th century. The newly formed Immigration Department itself was engaged in a process of attracting immigrants to settle, particularly in the western areas of the newly formed provinces of Saskatchewan and Manitoba, and there were literally millions of immigrants that came from the period at the end of the 19th century to 20th century, but what they didn't want. They didn't want blacks and they didn't want Asians. What was desired, of course, were Northern Europeans, the English, the Germans, all the white nations of Northern Europe were the desired ones. Plus, of course, the immigrants from white immigrants from the United States. I think that the background to this is the growing reaction in the United States in the Reconstruction era and the rise of really overt racist ideology, Southern sort of style racist ideology that we associate with the Ku Klux Klan, particularly the revival of the Ku Klux Klan in 1915. Canadians don't realize this, that the Ku Klux Klan found its way to Canada, became well-established as a mainstream organization in most of the provinces, particularly in Saskatchewan, the very place where all these immigrants were going, was the home of a really a very active Ku Klux Klan, but it extended right across Canada. There's evidence of, even in Vancouver of a strong Klan, mostly directed toward the Asian. Their racism was directed toward the Asian immigrants. But the Klan made a concerted effort in Canada to keep Canada British and keep it white. And the Department of Immigration under the Laurier and the Borden governments was the instrument of this ideology, and the best way to avoid the racial conflict that they observed that was happening in the United States in the Reconstruction era was simply this is the solution, as I said, to the Negro problem, as they described it, was simply to try to turn the taps. Close the borders down, impose as much as they could the immigration regulations that would exclude blacks coming from the United States and those that were coming from the Caribbean, which was fairly large numbers, by the way. We don't even have a very good picture of the actual numbers of black immigrants that came from the United States and Canada during this period, because the official policy is that Canada doesn't have a large black population. We don't have the Negro problem because we don't have blacks in Canada. This was, again, the official view that was being promoted by the policies of both liberal and conservative governments during this period. That's a really interesting part of this period. And I want to say something else, too, that's important, because most of the historians up to this point have looked at this period, the 1920s and 1930s, as being the low point of the black experience in Canada. And certainly from the point of view of racism, it certainly was. But the other side of that coin is the exertion of what was a very strong sense of racial pride or racial uplift that came about during this period. And I think that we have underestimated the importance of the UNIA in Canada. The Garvey movement was very prominent in Canada. There was over 5,000 active members in the UNIA, with 34 branches in every province, extending from coast to coast in Canada, particularly in Atlantic Canada and Toronto and Montreal. The UNIA was a thriving, driving force that represented racial pride. And that, I think, tells us that the period, although we look at the early part of the 20th century as the low point, as one historian said, Robin Wink said, it was the nadir, the low point of the black experience. I think in some ways it was an emerging sense of identity and pride that began to emerge, and more visible presence of blacks in the major cities of Canada, particularly those hubs that became part of the railroad, because the railroad, of course, was the conduit by which blacks were coming to Canada, not so much as immigrants, but in the railroad industry, working in the railroads themselves, in that whole hierarchy of employment, you know, from porters to red caps, the whole Pullman sort of image of black males working in the railroads. But that was a major conduit that brought numbers of blacks in the United States, but untold numbers of undocumented blacks coming from the West Indies during this period. So it really does challenge the standard view of this period and the number of blacks that are present in Canada during this time.
That was exactly where I was going to go. I'm glad you walked right through it, because I also thought that was really important, the significance and size of Garveyism in Canada, and having their own chapters of the UNIA there. And one of the most fascinating portions of the book, you included a transcript of when Garvey went to Canada and gave this long interview speech while he was there, and talking about black people's problem in the world and what we need to be doing to organize. It was profound. Anybody, that alone might be worth checking out Mr. Reynolds' book, just to read this transcription of what Garvey had to say during his 20th century visit to Canada. It's pretty amazing, but I don't think many folks think of the United Negro Improvement Association having large, significant followers north of the border in Canada, and having, you know, sizable black representation in that area of the world. Can you, because I think just all in, and it's in the same time period, can you talk about the significance of the eugenics movement as well? Because I think that ties right into the growth of the Klan, not just in the U.S., but in Canada as well. And this drive, I think that becomes a lot of the ideology in terms of why we do not want this Negro problem in Canada. We need to keep the Negroes out, based on our understanding of eugenics and how that supports white supremacy.
Yeah, I would characterize the eugenics movement really is not an extension of the Klan or that kind of really Southern racist ideology. The curious thing about the eugenics movement is it was an extension of a scientific movement that started with Charles Darwin's own cousin, who felt it was important to study genetics in order to make a better human race. So it was a kind of a social Darwinist kind of view that he used. So it became a quasi scientific movement in the early 20th century. Became very popular in Great Britain and in the United States and in Canada. And the target basically was the attempt to try to purify the race, maintain the racial vitality, particularly the white racial sort of vitality of the white race in the United States and Canada. And it led to some really unseemly practices and ultimately to large-scale sterilization that occurred with those that were in some way suffering from diseases and other handicaps, were classified as undesirable and the individuals were actually sterilized so they couldn't have children. And this was, of course, done against their will. Thousands in the United States during the 1920s and 30s and 40s. Really not a very bad chapter in the history of science. And I wouldn't equate that with the Ku Klux Klan. That was much more deliberate and obvious attempt to impose a racist ideology. This is much more a kind of subtle rationalization that starts with something that doesn't sound quite as racist as it becomes. But the ultimate the result of a eugenics mentality is, of course, Nazi Germany, and that's where it goes. extermination.
That, in my view, that makes my point better than I did. I just do not understand how that's not synonymous in terms of the ideology of the Klan. They're even saying the same thing, the purity of the white race. The Klan says that all the time, and that's the exact same thing that the eugenics movement produced. And I would even submit Dr. Frances Cress Welsing. She did tell us Mr. Lothrop Stoddard, The Rising Tide of Color Against White World Supremacy. In my view, it is verbatim. And I mean, yes, you have a scientific veneer, at least, that this is not as crude as some of the elements of the Klan or the Nazis or other elements, more rudimentary elements of racism, white supremacy. But at the end, we're talking about the same thing. And I would even remind our listeners, this is why reading is so important, from medical apartheid. This is the thinking that produced, as you just said, sterilization of predominantly non-white people. In this camp, escalating numbers of black people. Yes, I know there were white people that were sterilized in this campaign as well. But as it continued, it was aggressively fixated on make sure these non-white people are not producing children. That was Planned Parenthood. That was Margaret Sanger. It was the exact same ideology as the Ku Klux Klan. Well, keep the numbers of Negroes from reproducing down as low as possible. And in fact, let's see if we can drive them extinct. You had white people who were in the eugenics movement who were saying that explicitly. I have no idea how that's dissimilar from the Klan.
I agree. Look, they're drinking from the same, the water's from the same well, okay? That we both agree. But I do think that there's a nuanced difference here between the Klan and the deliberate and the obvious sort of expression of racism and the use of violence as a means to, as immediate means to express their hatred, which is part of the Klan's ideology, from another kind of racism that comes from the same source, and it is very much, as you say, ultimately leads to the same kind of consequences, which is wrapped in science. And it's not all, again, deliberate in those that are sucked into this kind of thinking. You look at Wordsworth. Wordsworth, for example, was a well-known Canadian socialist, founder of the CCF, the NDP. He was an agrarian socialist and very progressive in his thinking, but he was also a eugenist. Become very involved in this effort to try to improve society by selective breeding. So this was part of a mindset that was, I think, larger than the ideology of the Ku Klux Klan. But in the larger picture, too, we're looking at the same, again, drinking from the same well. It's just a different expression, a different nuance of that ideology or that belief system.
I want to get Viola Desmond. I can only say you have the Klan where we are lynching and killing black people, and you have eugenics, which leads to the sterilization of black people. If you all want to parse hairs and say that there's a difference, fine. If anything, I would say that the eugenics seems like a greater scope of the same thing in terms of we're going to kill a black person, we're going to stop generations of black people from being born in the womb. That just seems like a more devastating form of the exact same thought.
Well, remember, Gus, the eugenics movement wasn't directed specifically toward blacks. It was directed toward all those individuals that were in some way considered to be under the terminology.
And at its essence, is white supremacy. This is not the one that I'm going to bog down on just because we've been doing a lot of this on the program. I know I'm correct. I know
we've just been doing
medical apartheid. We've been doing this for months leading up to this. This is not even one that I have to tolerate for very long.
We've done this.
We've had guests on the program. You can go back and listen to Elaine Riddick. This explicitly, and I mean said in no uncertain terms, we want to make sure that we do not have a whole lot of dark people on the planet, and this thought continuing today in terms of the way that we think about the reproductive rights of black people, birth rates of black people worldwide. So in fact, even the pushback that I'm getting here, this could be another instance where you could be deliberately practicing laughter. Yeah. People that talk about that, laughter when white people laugh about something that is very serious, if we're talking about sterilization and eugenics. At any rate, I want to press forward because this is not even what I want to talk about right now. Viola Desmond, that's in the title of the book, Viola Desmond's Canada. I'm sure a lot of our listeners, even folks that are in Canada, might not know who she is. Who is Viola Desmond? Why is she important?
Viola Desmond, I think in a word, is our equivalent to Rosa Parks, although her protest was 9 years before Rosa Parks. And I think that's important historically because it again makes the point I'm trying to make in the book, Gus, is that we have a history in Canada that really hasn't been acknowledged, and we have a civil rights generation that doesn't even come into the textbooks. It's not even acknowledged to any extent. So Viola is a symbol of that generation of civil rights activists that attempted to confront the existence of racial segregation. She found herself. She was a successful businesswoman, as your audio clip clearly outlines, and does a really nice job in providing a context for the importance of her. She was a successful businesswoman. She was a beautician. She established one of its kind in Canada, the Viola Desmond, or the Desmond School of Beauty Culture, that tried to train black women to become beauticians. And she had 2 years of success in terms of that school in graduating beauticians. That went out to practice and establish themselves throughout the Maritimes, including Quebec as well. So she was a successful businesswoman, and she had business products she was selling throughout the province. And in 1946, she set out on her own, again, in this period, driving a car and hitting the roads of Nova Scotia was a pretty adventurous thing to do. Most of the roads weren't paved, certainly many of them. And she set out to make her way to Cape Breton, which is about pretty much a day's drive from Halifax to what was then an island, Cape Breton, that was had to take a ferry to get across from the mainland. Today we have a causeway where you can drive. But so she was quite adventurous in her business, business efforts. And she got to New Glasgow. It was about 100 miles or a little less than that, 70 miles from Halifax. And the car acted up, so she pulled into a gas station, and there she was told that the car had to get a part from Halifax, and she had to stay over in this town of New Glasgow. And she decided to kill some time. So she went to a local theater and bought a ticket, went into the theater and tried to sit in the downstairs portion because she wanted to be closer to the screen. She said later that her eyesight was such that she wanted to be close to the screen to see the movie. And she was approached by the ticket agent that said that she had bought the wrong ticket. She was to sit upstairs because that's where her kind would sit. And of course, we know what was being said there. So she attempted to exchange her ticket so that she would buy the ticket for the downstairs. And the ticket agent wouldn't take her money. So she went back and she said, "That's it. I'm sitting downstairs." She did. And shortly the usher, ticket agent, and the manager of the theater came and tried to persuade her to leave, and she said, "I'm not." She's staying, and so the manager and the ticket agent pulled her out. Well, actually, it was a police officer that was brought in, and they dragged her literally, physically, out of the theater. And as Wanda Robson, her youngest sister, explained in that little video clip, she was bruised. She lost a shoe and her purse, and was taken to the local jail, and kept overnight. And next day, she was brought before a magistrate and was charged. She wasn't given counsel. She was simply presented before the magistrate, and she was charged with defrauding the province of Nova Scotia, a one penny difference in amusement tax between the ticket that she had and the ticket that she should have had if she was going to sit downstairs. So she was given the option of going to jail for 30 days or paying $20 fine and a $5 kickback to the manager for his costs for bringing the suit against her. She had no counsel. She pleaded guilty, paid her fine, and went home. It was obviously for her it was an overwhelming experience, and her father was absolutely livid. He was beside himself, as you could imagine, as any father seeing his own daughter being bruised up and so inhumanely treated. It became then a cause for the Halifax branch of the Nova Scotia Association for Advancement of Colored People. It was very much modeled after the NAACP in the United States, and some prominent black civil rights activists were involved in the organization. They supported Viola Desmond's appeal to her case. She took it to court. Eventually got up to appeal to the four judges of the Nova Scotia Supreme Court. And all the way along, no mention of race, no mention of racial segregation. It was all the technicalities of the law. And because she had left it for so long in the process of appeal, she lost the case on a technicality, and that was the end of the legal case. But it raised public awareness, and it was something that hit the press at the time. I've got a couple of documents in the book that show how widespread the publicity was around this. Even the Toronto Globe and Mail had an article and a picture, and there were reports in the States about the incident as well. But quickly, receded out of the public consciousness. But quietly, behind the scenes, the NSAACP was active in putting pressure on the government, and eventually legislation was passed in piecemeal that eventually pushed toward toward the Civil Rights Act of 1963 in Nova Scotia, which established the basic principles of racial equality in terms of public spaces. So it's a history that not many people know much about, and one that needs to be told. I could tell the same story about Ontario, and we could talk about Hugh Burnett and the National Unity Association, and how he took on allied with the Jewish Labor Council and fought for racial equality in the town of Dresden, and eventually became successful, allied with 30 other civil rights organizations that put pressure on the conservative government, the Frost government. In the early 1950s, they passed pretty progressive legislation that prohibited outright discrimination in public places and employment and in other facets of public life.
Extremely important incident, Viola Desmond, what happened to her, and just showing that, again, I think some of our callers in Canada have pointed that out regularly, that we should toss permanently that notion of Canada being some sanctuary where there is no racism and black people are treated well, and it's just been wonderful. All you need to do is get across the border and, hey, things are going to be fantastic. Nothing could be further from the truth. Really painful illustration with what happened with Viola Desmond. One thing that, at least for me, is crucially important, it was so important that I almost wanted to start with this, but I wanted to go chronologically just in order of the book and kind of how the history unfolded in Canada. And you started your response in comparing her to Viola Desmond to Rosa Parks, and even emphasizing that what happened with Viola Desmond happened in 1946, which is 9 years before Rosa Parks' incident on the bus in Montgomery, Alabama in December of 1955. And I point out regularly, anyone who has listened to the context of white supremacy, this is exactly why I insist whenever people start making metaphors, analogies, comparisons, in the system of white supremacy, you should really pay attention, because most of the time, and I would have to weight it that way, most of the time the comparisons are not accurate. They do not aid in understanding racism, white supremacy. There is some level of incorrectness with what's being compared. Frequently, the things or the people that are being compared, they are not equivalent at all. And this is always, and I would underline boldface print, this is always the case when people... Sorry, we had a disruption. This is always the case when people make any sort of comparison or analogy to Rosa Parks. I would add Jackie Robinson in there, too, but we're talking about Rosa Parks now. And people do this. Right? Think Chris Rock, the comedian victim of racism, he compared Ellen DeGeneres. He said that she is the gay Rosa Parks, which made me want to retch hearing him say that. I don't know how much people know about Rosa Parks and what she did in terms of dedicating her life to fighting against racism, white supremacy. I can give reading material, but there should never be any just careless comparisons to Rosa Parks and what she did, not just isolating it to that incident on the bus. The first portion that I want to read for folks, not from Viola Davis's Canada. This is from The Rebellious Life of Mrs. Rosa Parks by Jeanne Theo Harris from her book on page 101, where she writes, and this is after Rosa Parks' husband, Raymond Parks, had lost his job as a result of the counter-racist work that they both had been engaged in for years, decades, well before we get to her refusing to give up her seat on the bus in 1955. So Ms. Theo Harris, she writes, the phone rang constantly with death threats and coarse insults. There were people who called to say that I should be beaten or killed, Parks recalled, because I was causing so much trouble. And then there were some who called just to inquire whether I had lost the job. And finally, when I was dismissed from the job, I remember one person calling and saying she was sorry and then laughing at the end of the conversation before hanging up. Most of the time, she didn't talk with these people. When I discovered that they were this type, divisive or abusive, I would just hang up immediately. Her mother and husband ended up answering most of the calls since they were home more than she was. Parks particularly hated it when her mother answered these calls. One other quick paragraph I'll read. This is from a previous guest on the program, Danielle McGuire, in her book At the Dark End of the Street, which I referenced earlier, which talks about the history of black people, black females specifically, being raped and sexually violated by white men, including Rosa Parks. She writes on page 120, Rosa Parks, for example, constantly received calls from angry whites who yelled, "Die, nigger," whenever she or her husband picked up the phone. Like other blacks committed to the freedom struggle, Rosa Parks lost her job and was blacklisted in Montgomery, as were her husband and mother. After an especially vicious death threat in the summer of 1957, 2 years after her refusal to give up her seat, Parks called her cousin in Detroit sobbing. "Rosie, get the hell out of Montgomery," he urged. "Raymond's right. Whitey is going to kill you." Now, this is just a snippet, and this, I'm not even going into the detail of what she was doing for decades, not 1 or 2 months, for decades before we get to Rosa Parks refusing to get off that bus in Montgomery, Alabama, where she worked on the Scottsboro Boys case, where these black males, black children had been wrongfully accused of raping white women. This is in the 1930s, where she was working on this case, in addition to decades of work to aiding black females who had been raped by white men. Her body of work for her entire life is astronomical. I don't even know anybody I could compare offhand to what Rosa Parks did, endured for her life leading up to that moment in 55 where she wouldn't get off the bus and following. I didn't hear any of that with Viola. This is no disrespect to Viola Desmond and what she endured, but I just did not hear any of that in her story of ongoing terrorism that she experienced, where she lost her business and her family lost their businesses and were threatened, where this was not just an idle threat, where she could have been killed. This is in Alabama, 1955. This is almost a decade before the church yep. bombing where those four little girls were killed in 63. This is almost a decade before when you had the dogs sicked on children, 1963, by Bull Connor in Alabama. This is the same place where Dr. King's house was bombed in Alabama. She could have easily been killed, and it would have just been, oh, well, another nigger dead. In fact, you would have probably had a lot of white people celebrate. In my view, it is astronomically incorrect, not just in this occurrence, because it's widespread. And the reason I think this is so important is because I think there has been a deliberate racist effort by white people to sanitize Rosa Parks' record. We're talking about someone who talked about bragging, laughing about being with her grandfather and saying, I hope sitting out with my grandfather when he was defending the house against Klansmen and white racists, I hope I had the opportunity to see him kill a Klansman. Whites deliberately do not want that record of Rosa Parks publicized to have people know who this person was, her quote-unquote rebelliousness, the militancy that she displayed as a black female working against racism. They do not want that record out. They really just want it confined to, she didn't get off the bus that day. Wow, what a hero. And that is totally inaccurate to the record of Rosa Parks. In my view, it's an act of racism. That's why I think it is monumentally incorrect. It should never be done comparing her to anybody, Viola Desmond, Ellen DeGeneres, anybody else. Your response.
My response is you bring to this the intensity and the depth of understanding of what who Rosa Parks was. I can't say anything to object to what you have said. The only point that I am trying to make in making any kind of comparison at all to a figure that's so monumentally important as Rosa Parks or Martin Luther King Jr. is to say that. The action that Viola took in the theater, in the moment, the spontaneous moment of courage, that singular act in her case, singular at all for Rosa Parks, because she was already well committed to a movement of change, and the importance of the moment is similar in the sense of, as Rosa Parks said, it was a stopping point in history. It was a moment of saying, look, this is wrong. There has got to be something. We've got to change something. We've got to make the world a better place. So in the sense of a stopping place, to use her words, I think that the Viola fits in one way, only one way, in that she had the courage to confront a system very different. In fact, the differences, as you've so clearly and emotionally illustrated, is a difference between the United States and Canada. There is a difference, and the difference is that we did not have the extent of the expression of racism in the full scale sense of what racism was in the United States. Not because we weren't capable of doing that, but the scale is just simply not there. We didn't have the 4 million slaves that the United States had. We had 2,000 under the British slavery, and we had there's not a million blacks in Canada. So the scale is so different. But in the singular act that Viola Desmond stood up and said, this is wrong. This is the kind of example that we need to teach our kids. And I'm speaking as a Canadian educator, that when you see injustice and you see bullying, you see, any kind of discrimination, you've got to have the good sense and the sense of justice that you've got to stand up and do something. So I think the example that I'm trying to use in putting the two together in the same sentence is simply on the one point of the courage to stand up against the face of injustice. Beyond that, you're absolutely right. There's apples and oranges in terms of difference, as there is between the kind of racism, the Jim Crow style segregation that Canada had was miles different than the Plessy versus Ferguson sort of legislated system of terror and segregation was imposed in the United States. world of difference between the two, and a world difference between Viola Desmond and Rosa Parks when you look at the history that that is behind it, and the individuals and what motivated both of them in the full sense. But again, the one point I'm trying to make is that in that action of saying, I'm defying, I'm protesting, I'm taking that that Gandhi moment, that Parks moment of saying, this is wrong, I'd stand up and I'm going to be counted. Beyond that, you're right. There's no, they're apples and oranges.
Okay. I would say, and this is, I even watched that when whites say, well, you know, you emotionally put it together. This is not an emotional argument. This is just an argument looking at the facts of the case, looking at the sure. record in terms of what Viola Desmond did and experienced, what Rosa Parks did and experienced. There is no comparison. That's not subjective. That's not my perspective. There is absolutely no comparison. In fact, in my view, it's so egregiously incorrect. It should be edited. It shouldn't even be in the book. And I would say this to anyone, white or non-white, comparing anyone really to Rosa Parks. I mean, woo, it's my, and again, I can only emphasize, if you don't know about Rosa Parks, you should get some material and read. In my view, this has been deliberately done to omit her record in terms of her views on racism, white supremacy, and just to really confine her experience to that one moment on the bus. There are many black people who refused in a moment to get off a bus or to move. Jackie Robinson did that, refusing to get off a bus. There are tons of black people who did that. That does not make them equal to Rosa Parks. And as I said, in my view, I think this is done deliberately on a regular basis, just because they do not want her record of conduct in terms of what she did, her views, what she experienced, and what she dedicated her life, years, decades of working against racism, white supremacy. And that just, that cannot be emphasized enough, because Rosa Parks, even though she was from Alabama, she ended up dying in Detroit. Why? The white terrorism that she was subjected to for years, and not just her, her husband, her mom, her parents, family members, economic terrorism where they couldn't get a job, lost jobs, were threatened with having their house destroyed or being killed. I just didn't hear any of that with Viola Desmond. And as I said, I would request that it be edited from the book. I think that would be most accurate. You can find another way to make whatever point you want to make about Viola Desmond. And again, I would say the exact same thing. I think Wanda Robson, Viola Desmond's sister, I think she makes that same comparison. I would tell her the exact same thing. I would be more patient in how I constructed the argument. But I mean, it is a monumental disservice to Rosa Parks. And I think it aids the system of racism. I'm going to nab some of our callers to see if they have any questions that they would like to ask Mr. Reynolds. And again, encourage folks, you should read about Rosa Parks. She is a titan of whites. It is incredible when you look at her body of work, what she experienced for the duration of her life. It is astronomical and deliberately obscured by whites. The caller in caller in Canada, did you have a question you wanted to ask Mr. Graham Reynolds? You should be with us. Yes, sir. Yes, sir, we can hear you. Caller in Canada, are you there, or are you just listening? Because we're not, I did hear you say hello, and then I'm not hearing you anymore. Not sure if something happened with his line, but we're not not hearing him. If you, okay, he disconnected. Maybe he'll call back in. Caller in New York, did you have a question?
Can I be heard?
Yes, sir.
Good evening, Josh. Good evening to the caller, to the guest. I have a few quick questions for you. But first, a yes/no question. Do you teach any black students?
Can you repeat the question?
Oh, sure. Do you teach any black students?
Yes, I do.
Okay. Earlier in the show, you admitted to being a racist. And I just wanted to know, can you tell me some ways that you practice racism?
Well, we talked about this with Gus. I am not a conscious racist. I don't engage in racism in any kind of conscious way. I'm merely agreeing that as a product of our society, I would be influenced by that society. So I don't consciously engage in racism, and I'm not prejudicial, and I don't harbor any hatred or any ill feelings in a racist way. So I can't say that I'm in any way a conscious racist. I'm merely agreeing that our culture is so racist that we all.
So as a non-conscious racist, are there any ways that you practice racism unconsciously and then later look back at it and said, "Oh man, I practiced racism at that point."
Yeah, I think that I can sort of feel a sense that that there's been times in my life that I have been subject to racist ideas, and that's one reason why I pursued a career of study that attempts to try to deal with.
Can you tell us some specific things that you did, not ideas you might have had, something that you did, and you look back at it later and said, man, I practiced racism at that point?
No.
Or not. Maybe no. Okay.
Yeah. No.
Okay. I don't think it's possible to be an unconscious racist, but like being an unconscious racist. Is it accurate in your opinion to say that what it means to be a white person is to be a racist?
I think that there's some truth to that. Yeah, I think that that our society has been so, our history has been so defined by slavery, racism, and the ideology of race that it's everywhere. We can't not see it.
You're blind. Okay. My last question, and I thought of this when you were talking about the rape. Do you think it was rape when those Canadian soldiers were in Haiti on a humanitarian effort and impregnated those Haitian women?
Absolutely.
Who were?
Absolutely.
And can you elaborate on that story? I'm sure you have more details being a Canadian historian. And I'll mute my line. Thank you, Gus.
I don't recall the details, other than that was a particular regiment that's now been disbanded in the Canadian military that was deeply racist and in a most obvious and most brutal way. That was a sorry aspect of our Canadian military that they were engaged in this practice in their service, and that whole unit has been disbanded. Doesn't mean that the elements of racism don't continue and sexism and all the other things that go along with a military culture, but I only can tell you is that was when I think back on it now years ago, the events were appalling.
Appreciate that, Thomas in New York. Caller in Canada, dial back in. Before I get to that, just underscoring my point, this is on page 175, where you write, interestingly, because Viola's singular act of courage at the Roseland Theater occurred 9 years before Rosa Parks' similar act aboard a bus in Montgomery, Alabama, the historical timeline would suggest that Rosa Parks is America's Viola Desmond. That, in my view, that is absolutely disgusting, just looking at the historical record in terms of, again, Rosa Parks' life and legacy. And again, this is something I would submit, it should be totally edited. Is this something that you would be willing to edit when you go back, if there are any, because this is a relatively new book, if you do any edits or what have you, I think that should be totally removed. You can, I'm sure, figure a different way of wording it to express what you want, but I mean, that is repugnant in my view, and it disparages the legacy and the reality in terms of what Rosa Parks did, what she endured.
I can understand your perspective, and certainly there'll be some changes to the book when it goes into another edition. I would very much consider making a number of changes. That would be one.
If I'm talking crazy here in terms of the comparison between Viola Desmond and Rosa Parks, you can let me know. But I mean, I have a difficult time grasping how it is Rosa Parks is America's Viola Desmond. I mean, that is absurd in any way, shape, form. How is that even Look, I mean, that should come out of the book immediately. I don't understand what would be.
Gus, look, you're bringing to the table, of course, your perspective.
This is not about my perspective. This is just looking at the historical record of Rosa Parks' life and history and Viola Desmond's life and experiences. Are you saying that these two are equivalent, or that you can even possibly say that this sentence is accurate, that Rosa Parks is America's Viola Desmond?
I'm trying to, in the writing of this book, I'm trying to educate Canadians to a history that needs to be discussed, needs to be studied, and it's been neglected, and Black history in Canada has been marginalized and put literally in the closet. And the whole effort I tried to engage in the book is to try to raise awareness.
Okay. What you're saying right now is not even related to the question, and it's just further disparaging the legacy of what Rosa Parks did. Like I said, you should take that sentence out of the book immediately moving forward, because it just, what you're doing right now, top of the list in my view, gargantuan act of white supremacy, and I suspect that you're doing it deliberately, but that's fine. Moving forward. Our caller in Canada, did you have a question for Mr. Reynolds?
Yeah, sorry, I just lost my connection for some reason. I have about, I think I have four or five questions. Two of them, Chris wasn't able to ask, come from one of our public intellectuals, September Anderson, and she read your book. The first question is, while writing this book, and this is for Mr. Reynolds, while writing this book, did you at any point, as a white person, feel like an outsider or oppressor in that your whiteness could limit your ability to make a constructive analysis, like as if you had no business really writing this book? Did you ever feel that way at any point?
I struggled with this field for 30 years. And this book is my legacy of teaching over those 30 years. I have not engaged in fact I've been reluctant to do this book. This book has come about as a result of circumstances that brought me into partnership with Viola Desmond's younger sister, Wanda Robson, who's now 90 years old, and this book is the result of the work that we've done together. Be simple to answer your question. Yeah, this is always a concern when I, as a white person writing and trying to be accurate and truthful in describing another race. Certainly, this is an issue that has been on my mind, and the same with I've done writing on Aboriginal history, and that's been an issue as well. So the simple answer is yes, and I've struggled with this.
Okay, and now her second question was, what needs to be done in Canada for Black people, such as, since we got our authors, such as Anafuya Cooper, what has to be done for them to be able to tell their own stories in Canada, talking Canada?
Well, I think that Afua Cooper's doing a good job, and she's done a historical a piece of history that is widely read and has had some significant influence. There are Black scholars that are writing as we speak, and this is a whole new field, or it's been there, but it's now becoming much more, I think, more present and more actively involved in by Black scholars. So I think that my generation of historians is going to be eclipsed by a new generation of Afua Coopers and others that are coming behind. One of my good colleagues from the University of Vermont, Harvey Amani Whitfield, has just published a really seminal work on the history of slavery in Canada. He's a young Black scholar that is going to really, really leave a mark in terms of really outstanding scholarship. So, yeah. I think that it's writing history and doing historical research that's important, and then reading the books and discussing them, having courses, having African Canadian studies. These are all areas that need to be developed, And they are. We have a, you know, the chair that I have is a chair that hopefully will lead to a more conscious attempt to try to create African Canadian studies in Eastern Canada anyway.
Did you have your other question, caller in Canada?
Okay, yeah, I have two more. Actually, I have three more, but I'll try. I'll see how it goes. Okay, so this is my question now. Isn't it inaccurate? Would it be inaccurate to really frame racism as an integration versus a segregation issue? For example, when you see the Canadian media is starting to privilege, I guess, Viola Desmond's story, which is one really about assimilating and integrating, whereas you're not really going to hear anything about the UNIA, which was really about resistance straightforwardly. So does this preference reflect the fear of black self-reliance / black self-determination? So in short, is integration not really simply a refining of white supremacy?
Oh, that's one I can't really speak to. You know, I'm a historian, and what I try to do in the book is try to describe the events of the history of racial segregation in Canada. But the other side of that is that that we talked about Africville, and there's an example of a community that was a self-defined black community that was crushed by the white supremacist society, if you will. And we can talk about the black settlements in Ontario that we talked about earlier in the interview, Josiah Henson's black settlement in Ontario was an independent black community that you know was tremendously successful and led to you know education and advancement of former slaves in the 19th century. So I think, you know, the UNIA needs to be, the story and the history of UNIA needs to be told. And we're only just getting there in terms of understanding its influence in the 19th century. And, you know, I think there's only one other researcher that brought this to light, an article which I read in writing the book. That's really made this into you know the context that it needs for understanding that in the history of blacks in Canada we have very strong assertive black pride and black cultural movement that like the UNIA that was you know influential and present in all the provinces. I don't think I've answered your question, but I can't say more than other than the fact that I've tried to do my best as a historian to describe the reality of the history.
Oh, okay. So I just want a simple, just for that question, just a simple, is integration simply a way to refine white supremacy, yes or no? You don't have to explain, just what do you think?
It can be, yes. I can see aspects of it being that way, but... I think that I just have to plead ignorance that I don't know where I want to go with this other than to say that I think that segregation that's imposed is wrong. Voluntary segregation is that's what you want. I mean that's you look at the Harlem Renaissance. That was a you know a ghetto that was defined by the urban environment, but it created an incredible sense of pride and the things that came from the artistic movements and the political movements and the sense of self pride that racial pride that came from that Harlem Renaissance were remarkable and influential and continuing to be so. So I think I can't say all one way or all the other. I think that elements of pride and self-consciousness are good. Black nationalism is good. But imposed segregation that's against one's will, to take a school away or to deny one an opportunity to advance one's education, which is what school segregation did in Canada, is wrong. It goes both ways.
You could make this your last question so we can get to some of the other people that dialed in, whatever your most important one you want to ask.
Okay, this is probably the most important one. Okay, so if you acknowledged earlier in the show that, you know, you internalize prejudices, just being in this society, something along those lines. So how is it that white people, all white people, can ever not be white supremacists as opposed to varying in their practice of white supremacy?
I wish I could answer that. I think it's I hate to think that the world is always going to be divided by race and racism. And I look toward some future where those divisions aren't so incredibly hurtful as they are. And I strive for that, and I try to be that kind of person that expresses those values. But I just, you know, I don't know. The more I look, the more I see we've made progress, but yet we haven't. So there we are.
You're just saying just buckets and buckets of words.
Let's see. Our caller in Michigan. Caller in Michigan. Thanks, our caller in Canada. Appreciate that. Did you have questions for Mr. Reynolds? You should be with us.
May I be heard?
Yes, ma'am.
Good evening, Gus, and to the callers and to your guests. I have three questions. Since you said earlier racism is everywhere and you unconsciously practice racism, is it correct for non-whites to be suspicious of all white people of being a racist?
Yeah, I think given the history of certainly of North America, well, given the history of white society, period, the British, of course, were very much promoting a white racist ideology throughout the world and white Commonwealth. Yeah, I have to agree that it's safe to be suspicious of anybody that is speaking, especially when they're trying to be a sympathetic voice. And I appreciate, and I've struggled with trying to do my best as a historian to accurately present and describe the history of blacks in Canada. And I know the reaction, and as I've heard on this show tonight, the suspicion and the pushback on this to me, and I appreciate that, and I've struggled with that, and you know. That's the way, I guess it is, and I'll take it with me. I can't change that.
Okay. All right. Well, how can victims, I'm a victim, and how can victims of racism, how can we determine or protect ourselves from those who consciously practice racism versus those who do not? Because even if you're unconscious of it, we're being mistreated. So how do we determine who's consciously practicing it, or how do we protect ourselves?
I think that it's an individual situation. You know, I think that in any case where you have people that exercise power over other people, there's an opportunity for certainly any form of prejudice, and racism being one of them. I think you have to take each situation separately and ask yourself what the motives are of the people that you're dealing with in white society. What's the hidden agendas and what are the motivations behind people's actions? In my study of racism, there are two forms of racism that are so clearly evident to me. There's systemic racism, which is built into the society itself, into policies and behaviors that's institutional. And then there's face-to-face racism, which is hatred that's expressed on a daily basis between individuals who have deep contempt for on racial grounds. And that's can be fairly obviously seen. A person that is racist, see their behavior is the best test. You know, that you see how they act and how they disrespect or respect a person. So it's an individual thing, and not all whites are expressly face-to-face racists. That's been my experience, and again, I can't speak for the United States. I'm speaking as a Canadian. I don't think that all whites are expressly racist, but I certainly understand that institutions and the systems that we create are racist, and they perpetuate racism in the workplace, especially.
I agree, definitely in the workplace. Why do you think white people practice racism, or what do you think the motives are then? In your circle, and just in your experience, not historically, I'm talking about just the people that you're around every single day and those who are conscious of it or not. Like, what's the motive?
Look, I think racism in any form is first and foremost ignorance and a sense of otherness. The two things that separate people: ignorance about other people, and that sense that there's them versus us. And once you create that divide and you see other people as different, then you start a mindset that leads to this classification of human beings as different. And once you have different groups of people, then the Western mind especially wants to impose a value system that one is better than another. So it's ignorance and a sense of otherness that really governs racism and other forms of prejudice in my experience. And you break down that barrier and you see that other people are just as human being, that you put your hand in fire, it burns, and all human beings have the same chemistry in terms of their humanity. And once you understand that, then you are on your way to appreciating the humanity that binds us all together as human beings. Go ahead.
Okay. That just leads to my last question. Who do you think is most confused or ignorant about racism, white people or the victims of racism, white supremacy, non-white people, and why?
I think it's deeply embedded in our white society, so it's not the victims, it's the perpetrators.
Are most ignorant or confused about racism and how it works?
Well, they're most ignorant in terms of the understanding of what the nature of the power relationship, and I think that they're the source of the problem. We don't blame the victim, and we shouldn't.
Well, that'll end my questions. Thank you for taking my call, Gus.
For sure, we had just two callers left, and we should be all good. The retired firefighter in Florida, did you have a question for Mr. Reynolds? You should be with us.
Yes. I wanted to ask him, do you think that black people are deserving of reparations for the practices of white supremacy?
Yeah. I don't know what form that takes, but I think that we're in Canada. We've going through a process with the First Nations that is a reparation for the misdeeds, particularly of the residential schools. I think there should be. I don't know the form, but I think there is historical retribution that's necessary to some extent.
Okay, that was my only question.
Oh, right on. Get through it quick. Not retired firefighter in Florida. My apologies. I got confused with the number. And I believe this is Roz. Roz, did you have our final caller? Did you have a question for Mr. Reynolds? You should be with us.
Thank you for taking my call, Gus. Yes, I do. I have two questions. Good evening, Mr. Reynolds. And I wanted to ask or discuss earlier, you said that in the book you prefer to use the term race riot rather than, let's say, white terrorism, because that was the term that was, I guess, the vernacular or the invoked term of the day. Is that correct?
That's the term that most ties together the events of the 1780s and the so-called so-called race riots that I tried to associate that or compare that to, which are the riots that occurred or the white violence, the white terror of the Red Summer of 1919 that occurred in 26 northern cities in the United States. I was trying to make a point as a historian to say that this event that took place in 1783 was was an event that, that set the tone for race relations that led that, that can be seen as being similar to the events of the 20th century. So that's where I got the term. It was the historians that have described the Red Summer of 1919, and I imposed that. But I think, you know, it is white terror that's at heart the motivating factor that's behind that particular event.
Yeah, because I wanted to ask if you thought that term race riot would be an actual refinement of white supremacy. The reason why is because when the term race riot is used, it's not saying, it doesn't specify the race. So it does give the impression that there is some sort of balanced combat between two groups of equals, when in reality it's one group completely annihilating another, or almost completely annihilating another. So even back in those days, because the media was also complicit in the system of white supremacy, would you say that even from that time, that was also a refinement of white supremacy itself that is carried over into modern day times, including your work?
Look, this point is well made. Gus made this point earlier, and you're making it again. I agree with you. I think that, that when you look at it from the perspective that you're presenting, the facts you're presenting, the way you have presented them, I have to agree with you. I think that if I were to rewrite the book, I would qualify this, and I would make it clear that this is the action. I try to describe it that way. I mean, there's no anybody reading the history in my book will see that it's the disbanded soldiers and the whites that are the culprits. That's the source of the problem, and the blacks are victims. And there was no violence that was perpetrated against the whites. It was all one way. So I mean, white race riot.
All right, thank you. And then my second question was, would you agree with this statement or not, and why? And this is how I would phrase it is, the establishment of the Ku Klux Klan in Canada, as it has been established in England and other white supremacist groups in European countries across the planet, would you say that that is a brilliant example, I would say, of the global system of what white supremacy is as far as that psychopathology? And the reason why is because the way it seems to manifest is that you have an active group, which will be these hate groups that are overt, and then the passive group, which would include people who practice anti-racism, because if those overt groups exist with the complicity of the passive groups that don't do anything about them.
Look, you're onto something. I think you're absolutely right. I think that the ideology and the expressed racism that is defined within the Ku Klux Klan is something which is ever present, and it's getting worse. And I think you're absolutely right. I think you look at Europeans especially, and you see the kind of hatred that's being stirred and cultivated through right-wing, racist, supremacist sort of thinking, skinheads and all the kind of other allied groups from Greece to Germany. That's targeting, not just blacks, but obviously the immigrants, and all that kind of hatred and vile behavior is something which it's like a fire. It starts, you can't put it out. It's as much a presence today as it was, in 1915 when the second Klan emerged in the United States and Canada. So I agree with you.
Thank you very much. I appreciate. Thank you. Appreciate your answer, and thank you guys for taking my call.
Right on. Before we let you go, enjoy the rest of your evening, Mr. Reynolds, I just wanted to get a couple things really quick, make sure I got it clear. In the book, there are instances where you reference Viola Desmond as well as Pearline Oliver, who we didn't really talk about during the broadcast, but she was another black female who worked stringently against white supremacy in Canada. You reference them on a first name basis. Why is that?
I think, this is a good question. I'm so familiar with the sources and with the families. And the other kind of treatments that I've seen have, when you talk about the culture of the civil rights movement in Nova Scotia, especially, there is a familiarization and a kind of informality. I interviewed Pearline's son and friends with him, and I think you know, I took liberty there, and you may, your point is well made, and maybe that's an informality I don't have the right to make. So that's on my list of things that maybe I should think about changing in the next edition of the book. I don't have a real good defense for that, to be honest. I have a very deep affection for Pearline Oliver, and I think that she is a person that needs to be recognized. And I went with great passion to look at her sources and to interview her son, and maybe that respect is not warranted in terms of the informality which I use. So, point well made.
Mm. What was the name of the, you said there was a rising black scholar you mentioned earlier. You thought he was doing a lot of great work.
Harvey Amani Whitfield from the University of Vermont has just published a really remarkable book on the history of slavery. It's a book that he's worked on for some time. He's also written about slavery in Vermont as well in his previous book. I don't have the book in front of me. I can't give you the title, but any Google search on Harvey Amani Harvey Whitfield will come up with his historical work. He's a black scholar that is really, really making a mark. And I think, and I said this earlier, I think that the next generation of historians will be predominantly black historians, and they will establish themselves as they already are. Fool Cooper has done her work on slavery, and I think Harvey Whitfield is made his mark in the history of slavery as well. With his latest book, just came out this year, University of British Columbia, 2016.
Hmm. I will be sure to check it out as soon as we get off the air. Harvey Amani.
I think you'd do well to have him on your program. I think you would be, and your listeners would be enlightened by his scholarship and his attention to detail. And he's a great speaker too.
Hmm. Okay, I will hop on that immediately. Just since we did talk about the area of activity, sex. Have you at any point ever been sexually involved with a non-white person?
No.
Okay. And the last question, just a yes or no. As a historian, do you think it's accurate to say that Rosa Parks is the Viola Desmond of America?
I think I need to take some thoughts on that, and I'm leaving that for the points that I tried to make in the book, and for the reasons that I gave. The one point being, again, the courage to stand up. There's that point of similarity, but you're right. There's no comparison. Viola Desmond was a businesswoman that found herself in a theater and had the singular courage and conviction to stand up and say this is wrong. But behind Rosa Parks is a whole lot more, and I appreciate your insights.
I still didn't get an answer to the question.
I'm saying yes. I'm saying okay. That needs to be looked at, and I need to challenge that my own thinking on that.
Okay. Was it yes that it is historically accurate, Rosa Parks is America's Viola Desmond, or yes, it needs to be edited, changed, revised, which just making sure I'm clear.
Well, I'm trying to agree with you without having to take my book off the shelf. I think you make a point, and I need to consider this seriously, and that's all I can say.
Okay, so that is another one where I just feel like we don't have an accurate answer. If anyone should ask you in the future as a white person if you have practiced racism, white supremacy, you should cite this program and this date and say the black people that I spoke with on the context of white supremacy, emphatically their position was that I was deliberately practicing racism when I talked to them and the way that I answered their questions and not being accurate, honest, being vague in some of the responses or non-responses. That should be one that you can give from this point forward. If anyone ever asks you if you have practiced racism, even if you don't agree, you can say, hey, the folks that I spoke, the victims of white supremacy that I spoke with on that date in 2016, they would submit that program as, yes, this was a day that Graham Reynolds did deliberately, consciously, willfully practice white supremacy on many occasions.
And sir, I respectfully disagree. I really do. I I can't disagree more from my motivation. That's all I can say.
And you did say earlier that it's logical. You said it numerous times. It's logical for non-white people to suspect any white person, including yourself, of practicing racism.
I agree.
Right on. Viola Desmond's candidate, Mr. Graham Reynolds. It has been interesting, the dialogue we've had. Thank you for sharing a bit of your Wednesday evening with us. I'm going to hop on my job and see if we can get Mr. Harvey Armani Whitfield on the program ASAP. But we should have Afua Cooper, nonetheless, on with us within a matter of days. And hopefully we can double down and get him as well. But I learned quite a bit reading your text, and I'm glad you could speak with us this evening, sir.
Yeah, thank you very much, Gus.
For sure, for sure. Context of White Supremacy. Again, our guest, Mr. Graham Reynolds, Viola Desmond's Canada, the book that we covered. If listeners have anything that they would like to share, evening, Mr. Reynolds, if listeners have anything that they would like to share, comments, anything stood out in particular from the broadcast, you can feel free to comment. I will get our sound clip in again.
You're just saying just buckets and buckets of words.
I think listeners and myself felt that numerous times. Throughout the broadcast, I will ask any of our listeners tuning in, I don't know how informed folks are, non-white people are, about Rosa Parks in terms of what she did, her experiences both before and after what happened on that Montgomery, Alabama bus in 1955, which was very close after the lynching murder of Emmett Till. I don't know how much people know about Rosa Parks, but man, oh man, that above anything else, his response to some of the sexual questions, his response about he himself, how he's practiced racism, white supremacy, his non-responses to many of the questions, white people being more confused about racism, him referring to these black people on a first name basis repeatedly in his book. And by the way, those are the only individuals he takes that liberty of referring to on a first name basis. And these are black people that are deceased. So it's not like he knows them and has been, you know, hanging out, going to church with them or going out to have a meal and that sort of thing. He doesn't know these people personally, even though he said he knows some of their family members, and he knows Viola Desmond's sister, Wanda Robson, who you heard in the introductory clip. But that's the only liberty, unless I'm in error in my reading of the book, that he refers to on a first name basis. All of that is secondary to that comparison to Rosa Parks. I can again only highly stress, really, anytime anybody, a white person or a non-white person, makes a comparison to anyone saying that this is the such and such Rosa Parks, there should be an immediate halt. What are you talking about? What do you know about the life and times of Rosa Parks? And who is this person that you're comparing her to? What have they done? What is their body of work in fighting for justice, fighting against white supremacy? I can guarantee you 10 times out of 9, and that is the exact way I meant to say it, 10 times out of 9, there is no one who is going to compare with the general Rosa Parks and what she did. And it's tacky. That's why I hate it when people bring up those metaphors. That's why I say that on the compensatory call-in. It is horrendous. That's what it is almost every time when people make these metaphors and analogies and similes. When they're talking about racism, this is what it is. It's total nonsense. You're comparing things that are not equivalent at all. And every time, without exception almost, it is supporting racism, white supremacy. In this instance specifically, it is obfuscating a legacy of a counter-racist soldier that white people do not want you to know about. All they want you to know is meek little Rosa Parks. She was on that bus and she didn't get up that day and she went off to jail and wow, she was courageous. They do not want you to know, yeah, she was around a whole lot of black people who endorsed getting guns. And if it meant killing a white person, that's what it meant. They do not want you to know Rosa Parks. Yes, I used to sit out with my grandfather because I wanted to see him kill a Klansman. They do not want you to know that about Rosa Parks. They do not want you to know Rosa Parks spent decades, plural, working against white supremacy, supporting black females who had been raped by white men, supporting the Scottsboro Boys, doing all of this in the face of death. She could have been killed at any moment, and her husband, Raymond Parks. They do not want you to know this is a whole family of black people who demonstrated, who lived for decades a prime illustration of Black self-respect and how that's manifested in all areas of people activity, including if that means I lose my job, oh well, if that means I don't know how we're going to be able to support ourselves, we are steadfast in our dedication to counter racism. They do not want you to know that. They want to confine it to this one little moment on the bus with no historical context of her life and times at all. And this, as I said, the same would apply for Jackie Robinson, because people make those tacky comparisons to Jackie Robinson on a regular basis every time. And you can believe me when I say, if I was talking to Viola Desmond's sister, Wanda Robson, I would say the same thing to her. It would sound a lot different. I would be a lot more patient, but that is woefully inaccurate. I mean, it is a monumental disrespect to the life and times of Rosa Parks to make any sort of juxtaposition and comparing just because this person, what they did one day, saying, I'm not going to move, or I'm not going to do this, I'm not going to do that, and said, oh, yeah, this is Canada's Rosa, or worse yet, Rosa Parks is the Viola Desmond of, I mean, please, the epitome of tacky and trashy. And I don't know if that point was lost. Again, it would depend on how much you know about Rosa Parks. You can feel free to let me know if you felt like Gus was making a big to-do about something that wasn't that big a deal, that there were other things that should have been focused on. You can feel free to chime in. And I'm seriously encouraging. People generally don't have a problem calling in and say, Gus, you are talking crazy. So feel free. This is one of those times if, you know, that point didn't make sense and you felt there were other things that should have been emphasized throughout the broadcast. But I mean, it was so distasteful and repugnant for me that was really something that I was going to start the program with, him making that comparison. And again, I can only hope that people will think about this when I say on the weekend programs, when people pull out those metaphors in talking about racism, generally this is what it is. When whites do it, I suspect they're doing it deliberately to practice white supremacy. Non-white people, I think a lot of times we just do this out of confusion, our victimization. We have unfortunately been contaminated by racists in a lot of the ways that we present, articulate, talk about white supremacy. That's a habit we should get away from. If you are going to use metaphors, they should be really closely interrogated to make sure what you're saying is accurate, truthful, that this is a presentation that is helping us get clarity in our understanding of white supremacy, not some nonsense that's just further supporting white supremacy and promoting inaccurate thinking. With that, we'll get to the folks who dialed in if they have any content. I didn't even ask. I was going to ask him about Black Lives Matter in Toronto, what have you, but just the buckets of words and nonsense was a tad much. I was done talking to Mr. Reynolds after we got about to the 2-hour mark, so that's why I just left off. I had a few other questions that I was going to ask him, but I was done. Folks that dialed in who have a hand up, do I have any commentary that you wanted to get in? We should have our caller in Michigan, Thomas in New York, Roz, caller in Canada, if you all had anything you wanted to share, or anybody else if you're listening in, if you had anything you wanted to share based on what you heard from Mr. Graham Reynolds, feel free. And again, if I was making a big to-do about nothing with the Rosa Parks, Viola Desmond, feel free to let Gusty Renegade know.
Can I be heard?
Yes, sir.
Well, Gus, I would say I think what you did was a magnanimous job in making sure that the legacy of Rosa Parks is totally understood and respected for what it is. I must say I was of those people. I'm a Generation Xer, and they wrote many, many books on that one incident. And I'm a person who researches like crazy, but I wasn't even motivated to research her. And it was listening to you tonight that's now pushed me in that direction, because a lot of that stuff I didn't know about at all. I was one of those kids who got the okey-doke, and once I transitioned from the African ancestors or Black ancestors that fought for us, that they propagate very highly, like Dr. King and also Rosa Parks and stuff, I really never went back to study her. So I'm going to make that a point. I think you did a phenomenal job with that. The reason I even brought back up the race riot question was because I felt he just did a terrible job of even answering, and he kind of dipped on it. And to me, like I said, all the way back then, they were already practicing white supremacy by using those terms in order to, like you always say, obfuscate the reality of what was taking place, not an annihilation of people who had no weapons or had very little means to fight back, but more like an equal battle between two groups that have weapons of equal worth that were going at it. And for him to actually reiterate those same terms in today's time, when the more accurate term is white terrorism, is an act of racism itself. One thing that really irked me, and is going back to roots, was during the whole program, they kept saying that the use of language in this show was the language of the time. I'm like, that's the language of right now. The word nigger is all day, every day. Thug is nigger. I mean, there's so many variations of saying the term nigger now that it's a joke that they would even try to qualify the language in the show as if it's something that we need to make some sort of excuse for. And to me, like, just the way he dealt with the whole race riot thing and his attitude, it was just, I was like, yeah, you're speaking like a racist from a racist platform, knowing that you're a white person who thinks you're telling me something when all you're doing is showing me your refinement. And the buckets of words, I sent you an email saying that he deserves that, because it was even within the first hour, he deserved that. It just, he was going on and saying absolutely nothing. And the questions he was uncomfortable with were the questions that he tend to divert immediately away from and go up into some torrential downpour of nonsense about something that had nothing to do with the question itself. So with that, it was still a good show. Like I said, every white person you have helps me to understand the nuances between the psychopathology of white supremacy and how it manifests in these people who call themselves quote unquote good white people. And with that, I'll mute my line. Thank you.
Right on. Other folks, hit that hand up. Did you all have commentary?
Can I be heard?
Yes, sir.
Yeah, I agree. Buckets of words. And I really hate those. I agree with Roz. I love when you have white guests. And I pick up the pattern. And he was one of the white guests that has a position. And then when you state your position, he automatically, I agree with you. I like those that stand firm on their position. I hate when they do that. And, he was practicing racism throughout the whole show, without a doubt. I used the metaphor or the simile. I compared the unconscious racist to unconscious rapist. And I only do that because I think that, like, racism is a crime of power and, domination. And that's why I make that comparison. Hopefully you would agree that that was accurate. But, of course, other than that, great show.
I would for sure agree on that one. Racism compared. I think I use that, employ that analogy myself from time to time. I would agree on that one. If you're on speakerphone, if you could turn that off, perhaps. I guess if you're driving, I want you to be safe. The speakerphone, it tends to get echo. Or if you listen to the program in the background, I guess if you're on computer and you called in on your phone or what have you, if you could turn it off, because we just pick up all the distortion in the background. Other folks who dialed in, if you had commentary? Yes, sir.
One of the things is the comparisons. This is a very typical white supremacist in Canada thing to make very lazy comparisons to the U.S. The only thing I didn't know about Rosa Parks was about the gun part, the shooting of the grandfather, but I knew she did other stuff before that. That part's actually fascinating. But even when he started talking about slavery, when he deviated from a question you asked him, I can't remember what the question was, he started talking about, it wasn't on the same scale. And I'm thinking, you just said that, they're not U.S. and Canada, white supremacy isn't very different, but yet he's trying to still do this thing where Canada wasn't as bad, even though they took out First Nations people the same exact way. They had slavery. Basically, it just means that anti-blackness just didn't happen the same way because of a lower population, but it's not a scale difference. I think he's practicing Canadian white supremacy, trying to make Canada look better than the U.S. But that's it.
Oh, right on. I definitely think it's different. I mean, it's white supremacy worldwide, but I think it's certainly different just based on the lower population of black people in that area of the world. I mean, you certainly, to my, unless I'm misinformed, you certainly did not have campaigns of hundreds of campaigns of black people being forcefully, violently killed and kicked out of a town. I don't think that went down in Canada on that scale just because you didn't have as many black people, unless I've been misinformed.
Oh, no, I thought he was saying scale as in U.S. is better.
Oh, okay.
Worse. That's what I mean.
Right, right, right. For sure, for sure. That our caller in Canada recommended that we get Mr. Graham on the program, although he had not read his book, so he didn't, I don't think, knew all the details about what he was going to present, Viola Desmond's Canada. Other folks who dialed in, do you all have commentary as well?
May I be heard?
Yes, ma'am.
Well, I just thought it was an interesting show. he's a professor, but I wasn't, I think I missed it. What does he teach again?
He's a historian.
A historian. Well, I thought it was interesting. I think it was Thomas in New York who asked him, did he have black students? And I think he really wanted to try to come across as someone who, of course, didn't practice racism. That's why I really appreciate the variety of white guests that you have on the show. It's really interesting because I've come to the conclusion after listening to so many of the white people and listening to the archives that they're racist. And the way he was just, you know, trying to refine and the buckets, refine his statements and just really, you know, trying to get around the fact that he's the racist, I'm unconscious racist, and all these terms. It was interesting. I had my 16-year-old daughter. She was listening to the program, and she was saying, wow, he's not answering any of the questions, and he's a teacher. It was just really, I was just really glad that she was listening in and really was able to just kind of pay attention to his conduct. Once again, you know, his statement as white people are more ignorant, I'm figuring he's a professor. He said that if they just get educated and learn more about the differences and all this other stuff, it doesn't change anything. So, again, I'm glad that he was a guest because it definitely just continues to shed light on the variety of white people who are racist and can really confuse us as victims. So, thanks.
For sure. That is great. Younger black people listening, starting to pay attention to whites and some of the ways that they practice racism, not answering questions and not being clear in their responses, not using accurate terms. That is certainly a huge one. Deliberately distorting things that have happened. This person is a historian. I'm pretty sure that he knows the history of Rosa Parks with those sort of comparisons. And in my view, that's not laziness. That's not sloppiness. It's deliberate because it's widespread. Whites making those sort of tacky comparisons to Rosa Parks. And as I say, they do it to Jackie Robinson all the time. I half finished an essay talking about that specifically, but they do this all the time. It's the same thing with Jackie Robinson. This is someone who could have been killed. Jackie Robinson, quote unquote, integrated. And even before that, he was a veteran in World War II. He did the same thing. He refused. He was on a bus and they demanded that he move. Some racist white woman got angry. He refused to move. And they called him a nigger. Move, nigger. What are you doing? And he wouldn't do it. And they arrested him. He got court-martialed, all that. But after that, when he, quote unquote, integrated baseball in 1947, he could have been killed at any moment. When he was down, was almost killed down when they were doing spring training in Florida, Trayvon Martin, when they were doing spring training in Florida. This is 1940s. This is nearly a decade before Emmett Till. This is nearly a decade before Rosa Parks. This is two decades before Dr. King was assassinated, nearly two decades before Minister Malcolm X was assassinated. And he was doing this. He could have been killed at any moment. And people just throw that around. Oh, yeah, this is the Jackie Robinson of gay rights. This is the, you know, Jackie Robinson of squirrel protection. You know, he's willing to go out there and put it on the line. I mean, it's just total nonsense. It's massive act of racism, white supremacy, and distorting just the terrorism that black people have experienced for years, what whites have done to black people, and just covering that up so that we're not well informed about that. That's why it's so important. Read, gotta read, 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 read. Other folks that dialed in, if you all had questions, commentary, what you heard on the broadcast, feel free.
Can I be heard?
Yes, sir.
At some point I wanted to call in and ask questions, but he just dodged so many questions that I decided not to call in. And I think it was the caller from Canada's last question. I think he answered saying that the world is divided by race, which I thought, after the conversation that you'd had with him, I thought that was ridiculous. I also thought, like, when I was listening to him, like, the religion of white supremacy came to mind, because how he stood steadfast in not editing his book on, like, complete lies and, well, at least inaccuracies. I thought that was incredible, because it reminded me so many, like, of the white callers that call in, that just, even when people are making really great points, really are just talking accurately, that they just hold steadfast to just lies, and I guess, yeah, I mean, yeah, just clear racism. So, one last point. I also thought, like, I think I keep on hearing this thing of bringing awareness to issues. I think that's also, like, a clear act of racism, because, I mean, like, what is he bringing awareness about, or what are all these other people bringing awareness about? So, that's all I had to say. Thank you.
Appreciate that. Appreciate that. One of our listeners even mentioned, I did write about Rosa Parks when Chris Rock said, he's a victim of racism, but he did the same thing. Chris Rock, when he made his tacky comparison, saying that Ellen DeGeneres is the gay Rosa Parks, which is even worse than Mr. Reynolds. And I said, you know, we should not support anything that he does. He's a victim of racism, but that doesn't mean I have to go listen to you at all or pay to see any of your films or anything that you're involved in if you're going to be disparaging. As Dr. Cambon would say, some of our grandsisters and what Rosa Parks did in her life, the piece that I wrote, talked about that in detail and just talked about some of just both sides, the monumental things that Rosa Parks did throughout her life, continuing well up until when she passed away in the 2000s, but also what she was subjected to. It is disgraceful. And within that post, I've talked about how this is a part of a pattern of disparaging black people who have done tremendous things. If you see white people, they still won't take the legend Ben Tillman, they still won't take his statue down on the campus of Clemson and other universities. They revere great legends in the annals of white supremacy. Black people who have done tremendous things, it's, whatever. Rosa Parks, she just sat her ass down on the bus. One of our listeners reminded that was Cedric the Entertainer's line from Barbershop. Again, disparaging Rosa Parks. She didn't do anything. Who is Rosa Parks? What are you talking about? All she did was sit her ass down on the bus. I think he sat her black ass down on the bus. And that was like the main little bit in the trailer that they used to promote and advertise this film. Just massive levels of anti-blackness. I would compare that the same thing when they had that filthy pornographic clip that was on Russell Simmons' website, and Harriet Tubman, and saying that she was in all these filthy degenerate sexual acts with some white supremacist enslaver. And that's the way that we should think of Harriet Tubman. That's the way we should think of Rosa Parks. She didn't do anything but sit her ass down. This is deliberate distortion. And I mean of the highest level, because if you don't understand, if you don't have adequate self-respect for black people and what our ancestors have done, this is why you hear all the time, black people are just lames and chumps. That's all we are. We never fought back. We never did anything. We just take what whites dump on us and we never do it. It's why you hear that all the time. This is deliberate racism. There are tons of black people who have done all kinds of amazing things to counter white supremacy, including counter violence. That's why I mentioned that passage with Rosa Parks and her armed black grandfather. They deliberately don't want you to know about that. That's why that's, in my opinion, that sort of thing should be taken extremely seriously. And you should really be mindful anytime that whites just try to portray you as being emotional. Certainly all of us are justified in being enraged about white supremacy, but this is just facts. You don't have to be angry about this at all. This is just looking at the facts of what the historical record says, and you're not being honest. You are being, as they call it, intellectually dishonest. Just based on the record, just based on the evidence, you're not being accurate in what you're saying, and you don't even have the integrity to say that. Practicing white supremacy. Other folks, if we haven't heard from you, if you have commentary you want to share, your line should be open. Feel free.
Can I be heard?
Yes, ma'am.
Yes, ma'am.
Hello, everyone. Yeah, I've been listening to this conversation since the beginning. And I appreciate all the comments and questions that y'all made to Mr. Lemos. Anyway, it's just, I feel it's an insult when white folks come on the show and say things like they're not conscious of racism or they don't practice racism. Like we know, racism is always present in Hispanic and society. And there is strong evidence that images and beliefs and everyday discourse produced and reproduced by educators and journalists and broadcasters, filmmakers, politicians, judges, and other white elite exert enormous power and influence on our personal beliefs. So it's in our face every day. It's in their face every day. Everything from mass incarceration to racial profiling, you name it. Anything about us on a negative basis, they are exposed to it just like we are on an everyday basis. This kind of virtue that he becomes professor. He's practicing racism, white supremacy, and the teachings that he teaches students. So I just think it's an insult when they come on here and say they don't. You know, they're not conscious of it. They don't practice it. I just want to have the kids. So that's one of the foremost issues in America. It's racism. Thank you very much for taking my call.
Foremost issues in the world. Absolutely. Absolutely. Anybody else, particularly anybody, if we have not heard from you at all, if you had commentary you wanted to share, feel free.
I wanted to add on. Can I be heard?
Yes, sir.
Yes, sir. I wanted to add on to what the sister was saying. White people talking about they're ignorant about white people. That's nonsense. Because you cannot maintain the level of power that white people have by being ignorant. I mean, you just can't do that, because if they were truly as ignorant as they play, they would have lost power just as soon as they got it. And that when you're talking about Rosa Parks, man, I didn't know none of that. I never even heard that before. I didn't know she was that radical. So can you? Gus, can you reference a book, any book that specifically talks about the militant Rosa Parks?
Oh, for sure. The one that I read from is a biography that's exclusively on Rosa Parks. I pulled up the wrong book. Jean Theo Harris. She wrote The Rebellious Life of Rosa Parks, now the author is a racist suspect. Again, whites are not ignorant about racism, so in my view, it's no surprise that a white person would be well informed about this. But notwithstanding, that book, I mean, that's like the thesis of the book, that this has been done deliberately, that's all people know. Basically, whites have boulderized the legacy of Rosa Parks, and they do this with lots of black people. Jackie Robinson, people don't know Jackie Robinson. Like I said, he got court-martialed because he refused to move on a bus. This is well before he integrated baseball. Matter of fact, Jackie Robinson, in his autobiography, he talked about how people laud me and say, oh, Jackie Robinson was great. He took all that abuse and never swung back. And he said, man, I wanted to knock the stuffing out of a white person all the time. And I wish I had been able to punch a white person who was saying this, to punch one of these racists in the face for saying this, and be able to go home and tell my son that your dad was strong enough to stand up and, you know, stand up and be a man while all this stuff was happening. They just done a tremendous job of erasing all that so that they just give you the little sanitized version that they want. But the Rosa Parks book, one that gives a lot of great information on this. It's, as I said, Jean Theo Harris, The Rebellious Life of Mrs. Rosa Parks. That's the one that I read from. It was published, I believe, in 2013. And it kind of goes through her childhood. It gives a lot of information about her family, because her entire family had been fighting against racism, white supremacy. Like I said, her grandparents, she talks about her grandfather being out on the porch defending the household at night with a gun against Klansmen. And she said she wanted to stay up with her grandfather in the hope of seeing him kill a Klansman. This is in the book. She has, I mean, it's just tons of passages. Like I said, that you would get a totally different perspective on who Rosa Parks was, what she was about. That is just, it gives a lot more context for how she got to that moment. Even, like I said, Emmett Till, him being murdered, that was like weeks before she decided not to move on the bus in Montgomery in 1955. So it puts a lot more things in context. It gives you a much fuller appreciation of who she was. And just the gargantuan price that she paid. Her husband lost her job. She lost her job. They endured terrorism for years. white terrorists threatening to kill them. And again, this is not some idle threat, even though I wouldn't consider it an idle threat now, 2016. But I mean, this is Alabama, 1955. She could have been killed easily at any time, and it would have just been, oh, another dead nigger. And in fact, we're glad she's dead. Troublemaker. She started all this with this bus boycott and everything else. She got what she deserved, because that's what they said 10 years later when those two white boys and James Cheney, when they were killed in Mississippi in 1964. So certainly, who cares if some, you know, sassy negress, if she gets killed in 1955 in Alabama? It would have just been, oh, well, who cares? But I mean, it's just tons of great information. I'll see if I can share, because I went through and did some highlights. So I say again, Dr. Welsing, what she say all the time, reading is more important than watching television. I would definitely encourage that. I was reading this book at the end of last year and encouraged it for other people, because I think they were talking, it was the last year was the 60 year anniversary of what happened on the bus in Montgomery. And I think Jean Theo Harris, she was on Democracy Now, and people were writing and talking about this, and she was saying that was the main point that she was saying, the author of this book, that that was why she wrote it, just to get more of the information out about who Rosa Parks was and what she was doing throughout her life. She was, she was a soldier of counter. If you want to think of somebody who was a soldier and dedicated against racism, white supremacy, Rosa Parks, bang, the general. That's in my mind. That's how I think of the general, Rosa Parks.
Okay, from what I know about Jackie Robinson, from what I understand, that they wanted to get his brother, but his brother was too radical. So they went with Jackie Robinson instead. I have to do a little bit more research on that, but that's all I wanted, and mute my line.
Sure, for sure. Other folks have comments? I think we might have got everybody who had a hand up. If anybody else had commentary, anything else extra that you wanted to add about what you heard from Mr. Reynolds, or anything else you thought was significant to add before we wrap up, you should do so now.
Yes, can I be heard?
Yes, sir.
Yeah, I remember Gus, maybe a year back. And they did a whole movie on a person that should have been Rosa Parks, and was kind of viewed to you that way. Someone who got taken off the bus like a week before, but she wasn't as educated and articulate. And, you know, that was just a practice of racism to downgrade what Rosa Parks did. And, you know, in fact, I still have to go with Harriet is my number one general, though, Gus. But, I'm definitely going to look up some of this stuff about Rosa Parks
because some of it I knew about the Scarsdale voice and all that, but some of it I didn't. So I'm going to definitely look that up. And this definitely has to be a reason why they keep that information from being taught, like most of our history in this country. Back to the professor, you know, I noticed one thing from over the years of Cal's, all the professors that you had on the show, how they seem to be so unknowledgeable when it comes down to talking about racism. I mean, all of a sudden, they're an expert in the field, but they just don't know about that. And I think that's definitely another way they practice racism. You know, and I like the way you started the show. You asked them, have you ever been dishonest or held back information from black? Here's a college professor, and which is why I asked him, because he has black students. Because in my opinion, if you're a racist, you shouldn't be teaching black kids. You shouldn't be teaching kids at all, especially black kids. How are you going to be equitable? I mean, it's like having a racist judge. You know, we're going to go back and look at all his grades, see if he didn't, you know, cheat a black kid out of a point or two here, or, you know, compare his grades to other white kids' grades. I mean, so to me, it's just, when you ask him, what he did, it's like he kind of admitted, yeah, I've done it. You know, I've been dishonest to black, I've held back information. And he continued his practice during the course of this whole show. And I'll be my wife.
For sure.
Oh, I have a question.
Yes, sir.
I can't remember. Did I ever send you an email about Zeta Elliott?
I would have to look back. I know the Graham...
I'm trying to remember if I did.
I would have to look back. I know the Graham Reynolds email that had Afua Cooper in that email as well. I think there was another guest suggestion in that one also, but I'd have to look back to see the specific name to see if you suggested this person or not.
Oh, okay. I don't remember.
So can I ask the caller Canada question?
Sure.
Are you guys, I know that you guys are still under the auspices of the British. I just want to know if you're feeling the effects of the Brit exit thing. Are you guys, are you seeing any increase in racial incidents since the Brit exit thing?
What's been happening here, it's been more of an increase since the rise of Trump and the Islamic stuff. So it's part of the whole general Islamophobic thing. It's not so much started with Brexit, it's just been ongoing. So like racial hate crimes have been happening, Islamophobia, but I just see it as like part of this broader issue of Islamophobia that's being a big trend globally.
Oh, that was Claudette Colvin who was referenced earlier when there were, like I said, there were many, many black people who, you know, refused to move on a bus or whatever the case was. But Claudette Colvin, I think, is who he was talking about before, the black female who was arrested for not moving on the bus beforehand. She's still alive. NPR did a segment on her, I believe. I think it was last year. I think it was the beginning of last year because that was the 50th anniversary of, or 60th anniversary of when she also refused to move on the bus. She has gotten more attention now, and there are books written on her as well, what she experienced, what have you. The theme of rape is there in one of the autobiographies on her also, because her parents had told her about making sure that you steer clear of white men, because if you're with them alone, you could be raped at any time. And again, nothing would be done about it. Core element of white supremacy. But Claudette Colvin. Anything else, folks? Wanted to make sure they got in. Everyone content? Grand. I will assume folks are all good. We should be here tomorrow for the Workplace Racism Forum. Normal broadcast time, 8 p.m. Eastern, 5 p.m. Pacific. Folks have people wrote in things in terms of what they would like either feedback on, or if folks have commentary that we'll share tomorrow. If you have questions that you would like addressed, if you know you can't participate live, you can just send an email, untiljustice@gmail.com. Medical apartheid, eugenics, again, reading more important than watching television. Eugenics has been a prominent theme in medical apartheid. Harriet A. Washington's phenomenal book. We are closing on the finish line. I think we have three sessions and we're done. Friday is one of those three, session 11. It's normal time, 8 p.m. Eastern, 5 p.m. Pacific. I think we'll be on every day this week up to Sunday. Stephen Jimenez will be on the program. His book is on the murder of Matthew Shepard. You want to talk about incorrect metaphors, where they compared Matthew Shepard to Emmett Till. Gag again. Phenomenal book. I didn't know as much about Matthew Shepard, but that's the white male. He allegedly was gay, was killed in 1998. This was classified as a hate crime against the gays. When they passed the bill, the hate crime bill, with James Byrd Jr.'s name on it, he was dragged to death in Texas. They took his body and dumped it in a black cemetery and urinated on his remains. When they killed Matthew Shepard, they said, oh, this is a hate crime against gays, and oh, how terrible, blah, 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 blah. Mr. Jimenez is gay, and he wrote this book. The conclusion he came to after years of research was that this was not a hate crime, that this was basically a drug deal gone bad. That Mr. Shepard may or may not have been gay. It looks like he probably was quote-unquote gay, but that is not why he was killed. This was folks who were involved in drugs. This was a drug deal gone bad, not a hate crime, not someone who was killed because they were gay. But that is not the popular narrative. As I said, if you hear people talk about him, this will be a popular reference for gay rights and LGBT war on gays. His name has been regularly invoked with what happened in Orlando. But Mr. Jimenez, he'll be on the program Sunday, 8 p.m. Eastern, 5 p.m. Pacific. It is an interesting read. I started reading it earlier this week. Man, folks want to do any extra summer reading? This might be one to check out, the Book of Matt. As we prepare for the program on Sunday, I know one of our listeners already did, or two of our listeners already did some reading on that and sent some questions and thoughts. So if you have read it or want to read it before Sunday, I think it's kind of a quick read. It's not too long. Drop any questions or thoughts off as I'm reading the book as well. Anyway, let's see. I have a quick passage that I can read from Rosa Parks' biography. Let's see. Here we go. I'll give you this one. So this is from The Rebellious Life of Mrs. Rosa Parks. This is page 3, A Life History of Being Rebellious. That's the chapter. Because the Pine Level School had a teacher, Leona McCauley, got a job teaching in the village of Spring Hill and was gone during the week, leaving the children in her parents' care. This was hard on Rosa. She once argued with her grandmother, who wanted to punish Sylvester, telling her not to whip brother. And I said, he's just a little baby and he doesn't have no mama and no papa either. Her grandparents had been enslaved, the product of a union between his mother and the slave owner's son, Cowbell. Rosa's grandfather had no discernible features of black people, but Sylvester Edwards was a committed race man. Because he had been regularly beaten and nearly starved as a slave boy, he had, according to Rosa, a somewhat belligerent attitude towards white people and liked to laugh at whites behind their backs. He took advantage of his light skin to say and do things that would embarrass and agitate white people. He didn't let his daughters work in white houses or want his grandchildren playing with white children and took pleasure in resisting the racial customs of the day. At 6, Rosa saw black soldiers returning from World War I acting as if they deserve equal rights because they had served their country and being shown that this was not the case. Indeed, the summer of 1919 became known as Red Summer as whites rioted and reasserted their power and position in the wake of the changes brought by the war. I think we heard this earlier in the program, and again, in accurate terms. A staunch believer in self-defense, Rosa's grandfather became a supporter of Marcus Garvey and his Pan-Africanist Universal Negro Improvement Association, think I heard that earlier too. Though often associated with New York and the urban North, Garvey had a large and supple base of supporters in the rural South who were drawn to his bold message of economic self-sufficiency, black nationalist pride, and self-determination. Klan violence worsened in Pine Level after World War I. They burned churches, and as Rosa remembered, people were often flogged or found dead. Garvey's message resonated even more. In the face of this growing violence, Sylvester Edwards would often sit out at night on the porch with his rifle. Rosa recalled that he almost dared the Klan to come onto their property because he was ready to meet them head on. She stayed awake with him on some nights, keeping vigil with him. "I wanted to see him kill a Ku Kluxer," she explained. Sometimes they would sleep with their clothes on in fear of being attacked in their sleep. There are many others that you could pull out from the book that, in my view, just again show it is a monumental error, in my opinion, for anyone to just be casually throwing around the name of Rosa Parks. And if anything, I would say many people, you should just keep Rosa Parks' name out of your mouth. Don't even mention her name. That's just, she's going to be mentioned to obfuscate and conceal an extraordinary illustration of black self-respect and a counter-racist soldier. Hey, don't mention her name at all. Just keep it moving. And I would even say it might be a good idea to get out of the business of making comparisons in ranking black people in terms of counter-racism, because it's probably going to be difficult to make those comparisons anyway. Just at the end of the day, people did what they did and leave it at that. That way we can get away from trying to compare and say this is the Rosa Parks of this, or the Jackie Robinson of that, or the Harriet Tubman of this, or the Malcolm X. Just, this is the person, they did what they did, and let's not even get into comparing them to somebody else, because it's probably not going to be accurate at all. There are many others where she gives examples, even when she was a child, and fighting against white people then, and feeling very much like she had to stand up at anything. I'll give it with this one. These were rough times to be black in Alabama. Daily interactions required a constant process of negotiation. Rosa McCauley on occasion stood, this would be Rosa Parks before she got married. Rosa McCauley on occasion stood up for herself and her younger brother. "Maybe the habit of protecting my little brother helped me to learn to protect myself." One childhood friend recalled, "Nobody ever bossed Rosa around and got away with it. One time, a young white man named Franklin began taunting Rosa and Sylvester. I picked up a brick," she recalled, "and dared him to hit me. He thought better of the idea and went away." When she heard about this, Rosa's grandmother reprimanded her, saying she was too high-strung and would be lynched before the age of 20. "You didn't retaliate if they did something to you," her grandmother admonished her. "I got very upset about that," Rosa recalled. "I felt that I was very much in my rights to try to defend myself if I could." Her grandmother told her not to talk bigotry to white folks. Sobbing, Rosa felt as if her beloved grandmother had aligned with the hostile white race against me and told her I would be lynched rather than be run over by them. They could get the rope ready for me anytime they wanted to do their lynching. That is a direct quote, by the way. Rosa's grandmother was trying to teach her a lesson about the cost in terms of survival, and Rosa would constantly have to balance these two forces. Militancy could get a person killed, and yet resistance, however dangerous, pushed back on the oppression and at times made it diminish. That in and of itself should be the quote that people should know about Rosa Parks. In my opinion, I would be lynched rather than be run over by whites. They could get the rope ready for me anytime they wanted to do their lynching. The general Rosa Parks. And I will stop there. If you have questions, guest suggestions, gripes, complaints, or you can't find something in the archives, feel free to drop an email, untiljustice@gmail.com, untiljustice@gmail.com, and we'll try to respond quickly. You can also hit us on Twitter at Until Justice, at Until Justice. Certainly you can use Facebook as well. Many folks do. Whatever works. And if you do not hear back, if there's a problem, just drop me another line and I will respond ASAP. Invest, if you think the program is constructive, racism-notes.blogspot.com. racism-notes.blogspot.com. Listener supported counter racist radio. PayPal button is in the top right corner of the blog. If you're not into PayPal, drop us an email. We will get you a physical mailing address. Huge thanks to all the folks who have supported, invested in the cows over 7+ years. I hope the program has been, continues to be worthy of your time and energy. With that, thanks for everyone listening in. I hope it was worthy of your Thursday evening, and we'll be back in 24 hours for Workplace Racism. I will again encourage sobriety would be best under conditions of white terrorism. You never know when you will have your moment of confrontation, whether it is with a race soldier or just a random white citizen anywhere in the world. You want to be able to make the best possible decisions in those moments to keep yourself as safe as possible and anyone you might be responsible for. Certainly, if you're going to be in a vehicle, you do not want to be intoxicated. And that is if you are a driver, passenger, even as a pedestrian. If you are in that vehicle, under whatever influence, you have just made the job of Darren Wilson, Daniel Holtzclaw, way easier to take your life, have you in greater confinement, or any other problems that they want to heap on you in that moment. Keep that in mind. Certainly, let's buckle up if we're going to be in a vehicle as well. Let's do anything we can to minimize contact with race soldiers and with whites in general. With that, Creator, we ask that you help us remain patient with other black people, victims of white supremacy. We ask that you help us remain patient with ourselves. Remind us to demonstrate the highest levels of black self-respect at all times, in all places, each and every time we are in contact with another black person. It has been time. Replace white supremacy with justice immediately. Cows signing out. Thanks all for tuning in.
Nigga, you so brainwashed.
I'm a victim, your brother.
Problem. You're a victim.
I'm a victim of 400 years of conditioning.
Shut up.
The man has programmed my conditioning. Mm-hmm. Even my conditioning has been conditioned.